Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode number 7. And tonight, I have my co-host, David Bixenspan. Bix, what's going on?
Not too much. We got quite the milestone of a show today, though.
Yeah, it goes against my normal protocol of doing this, but it definitely made sense for the week we are in. And on the other end of the line, we have our distinguished guest tonight, the man behind the awesome documentary Barbed Wire City about ECW, which was starting to get popular around this time period. But in this week, actually wasn't doing anything much. And that is John Philippavis. John, what's going on?
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Well, tonight we are discussing September 1st through the 7th. 1995. Now, we just did 1995 a few weeks ago, and I kind of didn't want to go back to that well again, but 20 years ago, on September the 4th, the wrestling world changed as Monday Nitro debuted live on Turner Network Television.
On Labor Day, and this podcast is coming out on Labor Day.
And this podcast is coming out on Labor Day, exactly. And this was a huge deal. Like I said, it changed the game. It forced WWF to change their entire way of doing television in the future. And it was an amazing time. You know, we had just talked about, you know, in the show with MLJ a few weeks ago about how the wrestling world was pre-Nitro. And now we are at Nitro. And, you know, before we go over Nitro, real quick, Johnny P., how old were you in 1995?
Well, this is interesting to me because I have images in my head of that night because I was going to start high school the next day. I remember 20 years ago this week, I was 14. I was scared to death, and my one comfort was like, awesome, there's a new wrestling show on, and it's live.
Exactly. And what did you think about, you know, WCW going to compete head-to-head against WWF on Monday nights?
Well, this is one of those weird times. I didn't believe it when I first heard it. I would periodically convince my parents it was a good idea to get Prodigy. Which, for people who are younger, that was one of the internet services other than AOL.
It was a huge deal. Huge deal back then.
Especially among wrestling fans.
Then AOL came and sent the free discs to everybody. And all of a sudden, everybody had AOL. The bigger thing is they went to the flat rate. Prodigy, at that time, as I recall, at least the platform the pay platform that I was on was like hourly, I think. And really slow. It was really slow internet for that time. It was still a baby. So, like, I'd say 6 months, they'd let me get it for a month or two, and then they'd see the bill and go, this has got to go away. And I remember being on Prodigy and seeing some stuff about, this would have been 95. This is right when I made the commitment, actually. Like, this week or the week after, 95 is also when I made the commitment to start watching ECW weekly. And I remember reading about this in early August, and this was my first or second time of going like, oh, wow, these people are real and not like fan fantasy fiction. Like I thought that that's kind of what some of the things happening were. Like I knew intellectually that these shows were taped, like the WWE Saturday morning stuff. But I remember reading like, oh, Diesel won the IC title the one time and like going like, OK, like, how would you know? Like it hasn't happened, even though I knew in my brain. Well, that's not live every Saturday morning. And then like 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, you know, they show it on TV and I'm like, oh, okay. You kind of nod to yourself. And this was one of those where I kept reading about people who I didn't know at the time they were getting it from like the Dave Meltzers of the world. But they were quote unquote reporting it as though like they knew, you know, it was just some screen handle on a message board. And I remember thinking like, that would be amazing if it happened, but like, how would it ever happen? And like, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, they started promoting it on WCW television. And like it really is like it sounds like so flat to say, or like sometimes hyperbole becomes cliche. It was a game changer because it made them feel more relevant to me, more so than when Hogan and Macho Man went over there. That primetime slot is what does it. And even though the show was in the Mall of America and I thought that was kind of goofy visually, it still seemed like a big deal. It felt live. There's a difference between just something being live and you kind of being like subconsciously aware of that and being consciously aware this is happening right now. Any that quote unquote anything can happen thing, like that's neat. That's powerful.
Yeah. And exactly. And Bix, you know, as a business move, this was a risk that they were taking to do this. They could have fallen flat on their face because God knows their product, you know, going into Nitro was not the best, and there was a lot of shakiness going on, as we had talked about a few weeks ago. So they had to come into this show, you know, with guns blazing. And as we'll go over the show, I think they did a pretty good job. But if this didn't work, how does WCW rebound from this?
I don't know, because I mean, I'm trying to remember, like, did they have a certain rating they were trying to hit? Because it ended up being more successful than anyone could have imagined.
I think they wanted to be at least at Raw's level.
At the time, though, we got to remember that at least the newsletter conventional wisdom was that would not happen. I mean, and that it wouldn't be, and that it would weaken Raw a lot. Because the theory was, okay, Raw was doing like in the threes, depending on the week, either high threes, mid threes, sometimes low threes. WCW Saturday Night was, and you know, one was in maybe a little more homes than the other, so it varies a little bit, but was like high twos to low threes. So you figure they have about the same size audience, so the theory was, okay, it's the same audience, they'll split the audience. And that turned out not to be the case. It turned out to be that there were a few million more fans than everyone realized. That there was much less overlap than everyone was aware of, and I mean, if this just bombs, maybe they keep the show and it's not live every week. I don't know, because they already would have changed things so much. Like, as we'll get into, you know, they change. You know, Kevin Sullivan starts hiring all these, you know, other different wrestlers. He wants to bring in the, I guess we can call them cruiserweights, but not exactly.
They were already there at the time, although they really don't work this show, but they're working tapings in this time period now.
Right, but I mean, who was there already? Malenko,
Guerrero were working TV tapings in late August.
Oh, so they were taping for WCW Saturday Night that would air after first Nitro? Okay.
Yeah, and Sabu, of course, would be the next week. And Benoit, I think, was the last one to come in.
Right, yeah, Benoit was the last one, and Alex Wright was already there.
Yeah, no, he was Ric Flair's.
But still, I mean, they were brought in for Nitro.
Yeah, and Liger, of course,
Liger was brought back for a Nitro. I mean, I think they probably keep the changes they've made. But I don't think, I mean, obviously I don't think they become as competitive with WWF if Nitro bombs and there's no Nitro, but I think they begin kind of a slow road back to prominence, maybe?
I don't know. It's an interesting what-if question, but we'll go to the show proper right now, and then we'll talk maybe a little bit more about, you know, this topic after the fact. Before the show, we had a little dark match. Dick Slater and Bunkhouse Buck, the tag champions, lost to this new team called the American Males, Marcus Bagwell and Scotty Riggs, which Dave Meltzer said the match was said to be really bad. So there we go on that one. The first match on Nitro.
No, actually, I need to interrupt. Had the American Males been teamed on TV yet?
No.
Now, had their video aired yet, maybe?
I don't think so.
Okay. Did they have the theme song?
No, not yet. No.
Okay, so I need to ask.
Now, I think they're testing it out, you know, because it wasn't that long after this that they started working television.
Have either of you, I know I've tweeted it sometimes, ever seen the video that they put together to get the gimmick pit? John, have you ever seen this?
Years ago, but three or four.
Not the video that aired on TV.
Then no.
Okay, it's on YouTube. They, like, I don't know if they just went to a production studio or whatever. It's this elaborate video of them with, like, it's like monochromatic blue filter video of this story of them as friends, and it's set to, like, a mid-90s aha, like, ballad-type soft alternative rock song. And it's about, like, one of them, I forget who, is with dating a girl, and then the other steals the girlfriend, and, like, they fight, and you see Bagwell's butt, and I don't know. It's very strange, but it was like they made a sizzle reel for the American Males gimmick that involved them fighting each other, and they showed it to Jimmy Hart, and apparently, and that's how it got going.
So is this like an homage to like Memphis videos?
Yeah,
kind of, but it's like it's a Memphis video. If it was like very, if it's like if a Memphis blowjob tag team video was a soap opera, kind of
a novella.
Yeah, adding a little extra, you know, add a little extra sizzle to it, like you said, sizzle reel. So
yeah. Oh God, that reminds me. I was gonna say finally, but maybe I shouldn't. For the first time, I saw Bagwell on I almost said Juggalos. Gigolos the other day.
Yeah, that show's creepy anyway.
I saw things I did not need to see.
Yeah. Moving on to the show proper. The opening match, Brian Pillman against Juice and Thunder Liger. Only went 6:53. Pillman cut back a German suplex. The Pillman had won the right to be in this match the night before on WCW Main Event, as he had defeated young Marcus Bagwell to be in this match. So
That was a weird gimmick they were doing on these early Nitros, where it was they would have a match on Main Event, and then the winner of that match earned the right to be in the next night's Nitro work rate match.
Well, I thought it was pretty cool because, you know, Nitro's an hour long show at this time period, so it's a special show, so you have to earn the right to be on.
I liked it, but it was still kind of strange. It was like, okay, you earn a shot at a match with Dean Malenko or whatever, like,
just, yeah.
But they had some good matches too. I mean, they had a really good Guerrero Liger match a few weeks later. I remember on Main Event.
And Pillman, you know, Liger.
Chris, yeah. you brought up something that's completely true, and yet you said like it was an hour long show, and you're right. That's what they did. That and Raw was an hour too, right? And yet. My memories of this from, and I guess it's because there's so many memories of like 3 hour Nitros and like Raw expanding. And my memory of this is as if it was on all night. And yet it is pretty condensed, like self-contained show in a way.
Well, they had the replay at midnight.
Yeah, but
yeah,
I would
they
have been
did replay it.
Yeah, but I would have been in bed because I was going to my first day of high school the next day. Like yeah. I wouldn't have even stayed up and rewatched it. But it's just funny, like it's funny how I remember the nuances or the little details of like this match didn't hit me the way the match that they had at what super, was it Super Bowl 92 or 93?
Yeah, Super Bowl 2, yeah. Well, they had that. Yeah, they had a really good feud at the end of 91, early 92, and this match was like the condensed version of that with them being 3 years older.
But not just that, it was distracting that, like, there were escalators, with people. I think there was a clear elevator, too. With people moving, it felt so...
Well, it's a mall. Of course there's a clear elevator.
Yeah, right? It's just, it felt like the wrong arena, so to speak, for it. You know, and obviously it wasn't arena. I mean arena in that verbal sense. Like... It's just weird to think about, like, that the whole show was only an hour and everything was kind of, like, moved through so quickly, and yet it's talked about in such epic terms now. It's talked about in this big way as if there were no commercials and it was 3 hours long.
Yeah. It's you know, how myths come as things go older.
Well, and it was only an hour long for well under a year, too.
Yeah, it would be later on before they added that second hour. But yeah, like I said, this match was like the condensed version of their classic type matches. But even though, I mean, Dave gave it 3.5 stars. So, you know, it was still, you know, it's still good for what it was. And the Liger was awesome at this time.
Pillman at this time was interesting.
Yeah, Pillman was going through some of his changes.
He was California Brian with the hair extensions. Yeah. Like, if you think, you look at the WWE Diva hair extensions and... sometimes they're bad. Pillman looked like he had an animal growing out of his head.
Yeah, it wasn't flattering to him, that's for sure. But the next match...
From the Horsemen, too, right? Like, this is like a month away from going into the loose cannon thing.
And we'll be talking about that in a little bit. Exactly. Ooh. Indeed. All right, the next match is the one that's remembered the most from the show. Ric Flair and Sting, which, of course, you know... the definitive WCW match of this era. You know, these two worked against each other forever. And they did their their normal match, except it was also rushed because, you know, the time constraints. Only went 11 minutes, 31 seconds. But this match is where Lex Luger made his surprise debut on the show. And we're going to talk about Lex Luger in depth after we talk about this show. So we'll hold our thoughts on that one real quick. But that was a big deal at this time period. So we'll come back to that in a minute. But Arn Anderson attacked Ric Flair. They brawl. That's setting up that feud. Just that was an interesting time period in WCW. Ric Flair and Arn Anderson feuding up with each other. Then we just had this wild deal where Scott Norton shows up out of nowhere. No, don't even say who he is. And goes after Mongo McMichael. And Mongo McMichael, of course, this is his debut show as an announcer. He had his dog and all that stuff. He starts, like, bucking up to Norton, laughing at him. And they're trying to push Norton as this, you know, big-time heel. And here's Mongo, like, riding up in his face. So it's, you know, pretty much, you know, almost killing the whole deal before it starts. Then Savage comes out and gets in Norton's face, which I thought was a really cool deal because Norton's a guy who I've been watching in New Japan, you know, knew him from the past. I mean, he was really starting to get good at this time period at what he did. I mean, he wasn't a great wrestler, but he was good at what he did. And Savage, you know, having like a maniac persona at this time period, I thought that was a pretty cool little deal there, Johnny P. What do you remember about Savage and Scott Norton?
Not a ton. Like, I just remember during that period, and it wasn't just that period, now that I think about it, like, randomly in the first, like, year and a half, they would put Savage in with guys that you wouldn't expect. Like, I remember, and I don't remember the exact time, I think it was within that first year, they put him in with Fit Finley and also somebody else. And they were surprisingly, like, really interesting matches. They didn't feel like formulaic nothing, you know. And I've never really been into Scott Norton, and that's probably why I don't have this like crystallized in my head, even though I've probably seen that Nitro like three times at this point in totality, and some of the matches more. But I would imagine if he worked Savage that it was at least sort of interesting. I remember Savage more for the end with Luger and Hogan and that whole deal.
Yeah, and they did work the next week.
It really was a hell of an angle, though.
It really was. Unpredictable.
And Savage does an amazing job putting over Norton as someone important too.
Yeah, because actually he's the one who says.
Well, he's actually the one who says Scott Norton's name too.
Yeah, he's the, like, first one to say the name.
He's like, oh yeah, you know, I'm not going to do the Savage impression this time, although it may actually sound weirder if I don't.
Scott Norton.
Yeah, it's like Scott Flash Norton, glad to see you're finally in WCW, you know, that type of thing. And then challenges him to a match and blah, blah, blah. But it was really, I mean, it was really, really good. And the next week they just kind of threw it away with a crappy, screwy finish with the John Tenta falling on Scott Norton's legs.
Yeah, what garbage.
Scott Norton told me that Savage had offered to do a whole program with him and put him over, which I believe, you know, I did that article about the beginning of Nitro for Fighting Spirit last month, and I believe him too, because, I mean, Savage, just because of the, you know, the way he did the promo and everything, and it just kind of went out the window. I mean, it seemed like it was supposed to be bigger than it actually was.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder if Hogan had anything to do with that, but, it brings me to my broader point. This is about the announcing as far as Mongo. This show, you got Bischoff on there being Bischoff, and Bischoff was a really bad play-by-play man at this time period. Mongo, who, you know, was playing babyface, but definitely more suited to be a heel as announcer. And then Bobby Heenan, who is doing Bobby Heenan shtick, but it's not getting over here. And basically, he's playing the character he played at the beginning of Raw, when Raw started, where he was, like, you know, doing the Rob Bartlett type stuff.
He did the exact same thing where he wasn't supposed to be the Hulk on the show, and then he invaded the show. I mean, he had the exact same angle.
But unlike, you know, Raw, you know, the Raw deal, he actually got to stay. But, Bischoff, Mongo,
He stayed on both.
Bischoff, Mongo, and Heenan. I don't know. I mean, I think they could have done a lot better.
Yes. Well, who else was in the company at the time? You had Chris Cruz was still there, right?
Chris Cruz was there, but they were already doing a gimmick on Chris Cruz where he was boring. Like, there was a WCW All-Nighter that I think that aired that year, around this time period, as a matter of fact, where Chris Cruz was in a suit, and he stayed in the suit the whole show. Everybody else is in, like, their casual attire, and he's, like, sitting pouting in a corner somewhere and stuff like that, and they're always making jokes about him.
Wasn't the idea that they thought he was nerdy, so they just kind of like a Vince McMahon thing where you just go, I think I have this opinion of this person, so I'm going to make him that person on the air?
Actually, no. I think he said something to the Observer where he said that stuff was actually his idea.
Yeah. And so you had Tony Schiavone, who was doing all the shows. And he's basically like Jim Ross, you know, earlier, you know, doing pretty much all the television shows. So Soli quit. Soli's gone. I think it would have been a great time to bring in a new announcer.
Well, they did.
Yeah, but still. I mean, I'm talking about a new play-by-play announcer. Somebody who would have been actually good. I don't know who that would have been at that time period. Because, you know,
who's available at that
time? Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Tanay was there, but not really doing anything, and really was never great as a play-by-play announcer. I'm just trying to think who else is around. Who's doing, like, independence or anything, like your occasional independence.
Styles wasn't Joey Styles yet.
He wasn't on
big stage yet.
No. I
mean, he was really good, but he wasn't on the big stage yet.
Craig DeGeorge was around.
It's Funky Mountain. I mean, Les Thatcher, nah. USWA and Lance and Dave, which, you know, that was.
Oh, I thought of someone. Here's someone. Mick Karch. Yeah.
Mick Karch. That would have been interesting.
Minnesota guy, too. So.
Yeah. Or they could have got Scott Hudson.
I knew I was forgetting someone obvious.
Yeah, our buddy Scott Hudson. They could have got him in there. But it was an ego trip for Bischoff, of course.
Well, but also, I mean, this show was his baby, too.
It's his baby. And he did a good job as far as getting over the stuff he needed to get over. But, you know, it was the second weekend that when he started, you know, criticizing WWF, you know, and giving out results on the air, which Heenan never took part in. No. Never, ever took a part in bashing WWF on the air, which was, you know, smart by him. But, the announcing was a mess on these early Nitros. And I like Mongo, but he just was miscast totally in his role.
Was Pepe on the first show? I thought Pepe was – I don't remember Pepe being on the first show.
Yeah, yeah, he was on the first show. Totally. I could be wrong, but I swear he was on the first show.
He's probably a better announcer than Mongo.
Hey, you guys brought up Scott Hudson. Was somebody from the same kind of group, Stephen Prazak, was he doing anything at this point?
I don't think so.
Not on a big stage, definitely not.
So he would not have been on anybody's radar then?
No.
Well, they knew who he was in WCW, but they might not have liked him.
But,
was he just a loudmouth fan at that point? Was that why they...
But I mean, he had already done North Georgia and Global.
Yeah, he had been around, of course, but yeah.
They went to center stage, though, right? So they So they might have been seen a certain way at that point. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So, yeah, the announcement was what it was. Next segment, it's another debut or re-debut. Mike Rotunda's back in the company doing an interview in a locker room where he's basically playing the Million Dollar Man or his old Michael Wall Street gimmick. And, you know, I don't think he was... I think he did call himself Michael Wall Street.
He was still Michael Wall Street on the first show.
And they changed his name the next week to VK Wall Street after Vincent Kennedy McMahon. And he talked about how the new generation is the few generation. And he's sure the IRS is watching him. So I thought that was a pretty effective segment. And another guy who, as we had talked on the last show, was promised, you know, the world tag titles with Big Bubba Rogers if he jumped over. And then they come over and they pretty much did nothing with him.
Right, and he left what was supposed to be an agent job.
Yeah, he left it. He's going to replace Tony Gurria in WWF. And
as we talked about last time, when he finally did get the agent job 20 years later, he replaced Tony Gurria.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, interesting debut. And then we have our main event. which was originally supposed to be Hulk Hogan versus Paul Orndorff, who we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But Hulk Hogan defeated Big Bubba Rogers to retain the WCW heavyweight title, 7 minutes, 8 seconds. Bubba worked hard. Hogan was Hogan, of course. Then we had the Dungeon of Doom attack Hogan afterwards. Then Luger helped make the save. And then him and Hogan went nose-to-nose with Savage and Sting getting their friends off of them and trying to be peacemakers and blah, 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 setting up Luger and Hogan to be the main event of the next show, next week's show.
The first head-to-head show.
The first head-to-head show, which we'll talk about in just a second. But to close this show out, the show did a 2.9 rating, which was, you know, pretty damn strong on the debut with a 4.5 share. And the replay did a 1.2 with a 3.3 share at midnight. So
midnight Eastern. Midnight Eastern. TNT didn't have a split feed yet.
Yeah, so, I mean, still, it's good rating for what it was for a debut show where there wasn't really a whole lot of build-up going in on television.
No, not like really,
it,
no.
It wasn't announced for like 2 weeks before the show, so... Yeah,
two things
good.
I think are important to note here, Chris. One is that, like, the shares would have been a smaller cable universe in terms of channels.
Well, the rating and well, both. I mean,
well, okay. The share is share of televisions in use at the time, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, share is always televisions in use, and rating on cable is always out of homes that have the station. So a three on one network might not be a three on another network.
Exactly.
So that always drove me crazy. Just I like when we were able to switch, and it was over a decade before people started being able to do this. But like, the rating would fluctuate just based on those kind of numbers, because people are always like getting and losing cable and television in general, and so ratings can be somewhat misleading. Like, this is not comparable to what we see today, as far
as always,
like,
total audience, right? Pay per views were buy rates. Now it's all, I mean, yeah, sometimes you'd see the total buys, but now everything's always total buys, total audience.
Do we know what the conversion would be of the 2.9 into millions of viewers? Because I vaguely remember early on it was like, wasn't it like 2.2 million? Like, the shows were neck and neck, and I think they were each grabbing like 2.2 million people. For some reason,
that sounds about right, that one ratings point was like a little over 700,000. Yeah, I think that's...
Yeah, I remember it wasn't quite equal to a million at that point,
no,
as I recall. Okay.
But so, yeah, something right, like 700,000 does sound right. 700,000.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's still like sizable. Like, both of them started out, and I mean, then it would boom and be like ridiculous between the two. But that still had to be shocking when that came in to like the executive office of Turner to see that. You know, because I mean, Bischoff always tells that story of like being in the, which is, you know, could be somewhat mythologized, but I mean, it's kind of self-deprecating, actually. He says, like, I didn't have an idea in the world when Ted Turner asked me, like, what do we have to do? So I just say, oh, well, they have a show on Monday nights in primetime, and we're on Saturdays at 6:05. And he turns and looks at the one executive from Turner whose name escapes me.
He's Scott Sasso.
Thank you. And he claims Scott Sasso was like, jaw drop. Like, what? So I have to imagine that Scott Sasso was pleasantly surprised, even if he was holding his nose through this whole experience.
Well, that's not what the meeting was about, though. And the meeting was that Bischoff had gotten an in to get them on in China on, I think it was Star TV or something like that. But the problem was that it was owned by Rupert Murdoch. And Rupert Murdoch and Turner were and always will be mortal enemies. And he was like, this is a deal we have to make, but I can't make this deal without talking to Ted Turner. So I have to arrange through Scott Sasso to get a meeting with Ted Turner to go over this. And before he's barely into his pitch, and then Ted's like, so what do we need to, why aren't we competitive with Vince? What do we need to do? And that's how this whole thing came about. And
and the big blow, it happens, you know, Nitro was the, you know, a big story, but this is a bigger story because on August 31st, Lex Luger signs a 2-year contract with WCW and quietly with only Eric Bischoff and, WCW lawyer Nick Lambrose, the only ones that knew about the deal ahead of time, although it was known by people in the business that he had been negotiating with them. Now, those negotiations have fallen apart, though, only after WCW offered him $1,000 per night with no guarantee. The hope was that a deal would have been made before the WCW press conference in New York announced Nitro a few weeks earlier, so Luger could have walked out as a surprise there instead. The original plan at this time was for Luger to come out, pop a rating, then job to Hogan as a notch on his belt buckle. The deal was put back together, though, after the Paul Orndorff Big Van Vader bathroom brawl on August 30th at Center Stage in Atlanta, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And Luger had just been a major part of the WFTV tapings on August 28th and 29th, where he did a stretcher job for Men on the Mission and Davey Boy Smith, which was to set up Luger and Mabel coming back on television on September the 9th, which, of course, didn't happen. And Luger claims that he was working in WWF without a contract and was free to do what he wanted to when he wanted to. So he worked the house shows in the Maritimes, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, over the weekend.
Under WCW contract.
Under WCW contract, and then flew directly into Minneapolis, and it was being rumored at the time that Luger was going to become a member of the Four Horsemen with Arn, Flair, and Brian Pillman. Now, WWF is claiming that Luger had a valid contract with the organization through January 6, 1996. Luger has claimed all along that he was wrestling with Titan for the past few months without a contract and thus was free to make the jump at any point. Apparently, Luger, according to sources within WCW, is now claiming that Titan put Whiteout on his original contract and filled in a new later date in order to make this claim, and that his contract had long since expired. No lawsuit has been filed by WWF in regard to the Luger jump at this point, but the situation is said to be in hands of the lawyers. According to other sources, the word that Luger informed Vince McMahon he was going to WCW was said to be denied, with a report that McMahon found out about Luger joining WCW at the same time that the rest of the country did while watching Monday Nitro on September the 4th. Now, Bix, a lot going on here. Luger, I mean, we look at his WWF run, and it was a disappointment in a lot of ways. And now he's coming back to WCW and, you know, going to be the focal point of the new Nitro show to start off with. Getting big money contract, again, guaranteed money. The guy's a master. What can I say?
He wasn't getting a lot of money, though. I mean, he was getting like $150,000. I mean, by Lex Luger standards, he wasn't getting a lot of money. He was getting he ended up getting $150,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, as far as the contract thing, I'm pretty sure. Now, these days, doesn't everyone just say that his contract had expired?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's weird because you hear what was in the newsletters then. It's like, when you look at the trajectories of his WWF run, January 6th, or what was it, January 3rd, 1996? That sounds like that 3 years from probably when he would have signed his wrestler contract, because he debuted in January 93 as a wrestler, so that sounds like it would make sense. Even I always felt like there's a missing piece of the puzzle here.
His WBF contract was his original wrestler contract, though. He carried that contract over. And I don't know when exactly he signed a new wrestler contract.
But it
wasn't that early, though. I think it was maybe later in 93.
No, but he started in 93 as a wrestler in January, so... But it sounds like it would make sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean this. I mean it. He was getting moved back into main events in WWF after a break, but I mean this was definitely the right.
Well,
move for
he
him.
Was held off SummerSlam, and the reason for that was is they were scared of him negotiating with WCW.
Well, he was so on SummerSlam though. He was
yeah,
on the show.
They held him off.
Yeah,
they held him and Davey off the show.
Yeah,
because of that fear.
Yeah, but I mean, he definitely made the right move. I mean,
totally.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, especially with Davey, I mean, he's probably just Davey's fodder going into the Diesel match, I would think, right?
Well, they're starting some with him and Mabel, and who knows where that goes. But yeah, I mean, Luger's prospects. Okay, let's look at. Who would you rather work against? Would you rather be Mabel working a B-show, house show main event?
Or would you rather
work against Hulk Hogan?
And Ric Flair and Randy Savage.
And Sting. Gee, I wonder what decision I'd make. So, yeah, I mean, he made the right move. Now, Johnny P, Luger in WCW, you know, in the early 90s was pretty damn awesome. You know, we've been trying to rehab his legacy. You know, on these podcasts, you know, made people realize how good he was. 1995 Lex Luger had been, I would say, kind of spiritually beaten up by this time period by his WF run and not getting the title and all this other stuff. He seemed like he was kind of refreshed when he showed back up at WCW again.
I will speak in Bischoff speak to answer that and say, I believe you mean his brand was damaged.
Totally.
Yeah, there's so many. Oh God, I can't even keep mentally organized all the different things just in that blurb that you read. First of all, this is like the moment where things start to change. Like it's not just the big jump that everybody remembers in the live TV. There's the whole business aspect to it that he flipped on McMahon and did this, and you know, the whole guaranteed contract thing, which did exist, but. A lot of times in the 90s, and it didn't clear up all at once. It's like real history. Like what I mean by real history, just like your general U.S. history or world history, where you ask for some simplification, and what you get is like, look, this happened over time. Because I always remember in the 90s, these guys just there was still that kind of territory type contract to some degree, even on the big stage, where like guys would just be like, well, I'm going home. Or, you know, guys would be paid for certain dates for things and they wouldn't be punished for different things that they did because it was per date or something like that.
It was like you were guaranteed, all you were guaranteed was like 15 dates and like no, and the $25 per date because they could just be TV or whatever.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't a downside type of contract. Even though there were guaranteed contracts before that, it was kind of a gated thing instead of what, you know, the standard. I will say one thing, like the comments that you guys made before about like, which would you rather do? I don't know that Luger would have thought like that because Luger was more of a businessman than a wrestling artist or star.
Well, yes, but.
Sting's there. I mean, and him and Sting were still best friends.
Right. And
well, that's how we got in. Yeah. That's because, I mean, Bischoff's talked, depending on the interview that you either read and or watch video of, and depending on, you know, how far he expounds because of editing and just his, you know, what he is.
And his mood.
Exactly. He tends to, I don't know that he's ever outright said it this way, but he's completely pointed to it and inferred that he said he didn't like Luger. He met with him, you know, the week before or whatever. And like, he just found, oh, he's still an arrogant, pompous ass. I don't like him. And he didn't see as much value in him. And he was going to, so he tried to lowball him, as I recall, to
right,
some
the
degree.
$150,000 or whatever it was. Yeah.
Yeah. But he wanted to appease Sting because Sting was the more important chip in his mind, I think. Yeah. Or that's what he basically puts forth. And I do find it interesting, though, because he had to see the value. I think he did see the value in having this guy on live TV. Luger, wrestling is always my the co-director of Barbed Wire City, cheap plug. Kevin Karen, who's not a wrestling fan, always points out things that I don't notice as much because I'm in this world. And whenever he sees video of stuff like the Luger jump or something, he always goes, God, wrestling was always like 5 to 10 years behind the times in fashion. And I just
shirt. What is that shirt that he wears?
The shirt. It's the shirt. Exactly. The button up. It's a button up that goes really high on the collar. Yeah. And yeah, the collar is ridiculous. And he's so massive that it's just, he comes out and like, as a kid, I was like, oh my God, Lex Luger's there. That's crazy. Because
and he grew his hair back long. His hair was back long again after cutting it shorter. So, yeah, he was kind of looking like 1987 Lex Luger again in the way. 88 Lex Luger. And wearing shirts in 1988.
I think Luger figured that even if I get moved back up in, like, incrementally in WWE, if I take the smaller contract now, I have the ability to grow more.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Two steps forward kind of mentality. And he's like, I got my best friend and they want to make him happy. I can leverage. And I think he probably made I've always believed he made the right decision for him. And it kind of bore out that way.
Yeah. He got lucky too.
Yeah. But he was too damaged in WWE to really be what a temperamental Vince McMahon wanted him to be.
Well, here's how he got lucky. All right. Regarding Big Van Vader, Luger basically took Vader's spot in the angle with Hulk Hogan on the debut Nitro, as Hogan versus Vader was supposed to be the main event of the September 11th Nitro, with Vader possibly even winning the title to give that show the juice that it needed to say, hey, we're going to change the world title on this show. With Vader's $700,000 a year salary being possibly off the books due to how he would leave the company through disciplinary actions, it made the Luger renegotiations much easier. So he got, you know, some extra help in the pocketbook because of Vader. Now, let's talk about that situation. The Leon Wyatt, Paul Orndorff situation that took place Wednesday afternoon, several hours before the TV taping of Center Stage, Wyatt, who according to one report had arrived late at the building, was told by Orndorff that they wanted him out for interviews with Gene Okerlund. It should be noted that for whatever reason, there was prior heat between the two of them before this took place. Wyatt was taking his time, and Orndorff started yelling at him, not in as much as a bad way as a way that one would figure a high school football coach yelling at a player. WCW officials were saying that if he didn't hurry up and finish the interviews, they'd have to pay dinner pay for the crew because they were already behind schedule. Wyatt then growled at Orndorff, and at this point, according to eyewitness reports, Wyatt and Orndorff traded words, which turned into a cussing contest and grew more heated for several minutes, at which point Orndorff repeatedly called Wyatt a fat prima donna. The two at this point were swearing to each other chest to chest when reportedly Orndorff told Wyatt to make his move. After more of a chest to chest swearing contest, Wyatt threw a palm blow to the chest, which knocked Orndorff down. Orndorff got up, went to tackle Wyatt, and while this was going on, the other wrestlers largely did what was described as a pathetic pull apart. With everyone around, Orndorff threw a perfect left, which is his bad arm, to Wyatt's head and knocked him silly, with Wyatt hitting the deck. At this point, Orndorff threw kick after kick at the stunned Wyatt's face while Wyatt tried to cover up in the fetal position on the ground before it was broken up. Orndorff was wearing sandals, so it minimized the damage from the kicks as compared to the cowboy boots that most wrestlers wear. Wyatt's face was a mess at this point, with both eyes puffed up from the kicks and a bloody lip. And if Orndorff had been wearing cowboy boots, the potential damage could have been very serious. Wyatt was stunned on the ground for several minutes before he finally got his bearings together. And when he finally recovered, he went to the office that Orndorff was in. The two started arguing again and went to blows. This time they traded punches, with Orndorff coming out of it with a black eye and a bloody lip. And Wyatt, who went into the ring with a messed up face, came out even messier before the two were separated again. At this point, Wyatt was sent home and pulled from the taping. Orndorff, with a black eye, worked his scheduled squash match at the taping with Barry Houston. Orndorff became something of a John Wayne type hero in the front office, since Wyatt outweighed him by 200 pounds. And is 7 years younger, 39 to 46. And Orndorff, who has had a reputation as being a tough guy going back to the early 80s, came out of the confrontation in far better shape. There used to be a joke in wrestling, because Orndorff was an avid hunter, that Orndorff really didn't need a weapon to go hunting. Orndorff said he had no problem with Wyatt coming back and didn't want to stand in the way of a decision to bring him back. According to WCW sources, Wyatt has said they've been apologizing for everything that happened. Still, two signs that Wyatt being brought back is far from a certainty are both the appearance of Luger taking Vader's spot on the 9/11 show and the fact that during the entire Nitro broadcast, Vader's name was never uttered except in a pre-produced War Games commercial. Since Wyatt is known as being a very smart to when it comes to personal business, losing this deal over something like this would be a huge mistake. According to one source, he has gotten several extensions and raises using various things such as UWFI as leverage. So his guaranteed $625,000 to $750,000 per year deal is valid according to sources through 1998 or 1999. If he were to go to WWF, which would be almost certain end result if WCW wouldn't take him back, he'd be working four times as much for a lot less money. He'd be far more recognized in airports. They would almost surely get a lengthy run at the top as a top heel in the company. But at 39 with a history of back and knee problems, I'm not sure that takes precedence over a guaranteed contract. Not to mention that at his weight and with the bumps he takes and the type of match he works on the big shows, he's been very injury prone and has missed numerous house shows even on the relatively easier WCW road schedule. He does have a great track record when it comes to putting on great matches on the major shows, and there has never been anyone in his size anywhere close to his level as a worker. Wow. Okay. Johnny P. Paul.
Yes, sir.
Is a tough motherfucker.
Yeah, really, because they, like, one of the things, and it goes even
how close are you to your mic or phone or whatever you're using?
I'm using my cell phone.
Okay, that's better. I don't know if that was you or if that was the or if that was your phone, because now it sounds better.
Yeah, you're good now.
Okay, yeah, I wasn't sure. This is interesting not only for the way wrestling was, but also for the way it was reported on. And this is another one of those sign of the times things. Like, even the way – I assume this is from The Observer, this report. Chris, is that true?
Yes.
Okay. It is, like, written as though, like, Orndorff really proved he was a real man. and this – this hurts the credibility of Vader, which is hilarious because the only people that are really going to know about it are people inside the company and that little itty bitty percentage that either call into the phone lines, the toll, the 900
numbers, or the
people who read the sheets at this time, which would have been a very small percentage of people. But that perception, I think, really helped to be the final nail in his coffin. I mean, it didn't help that I, you know, again, this is the Eric Bischoff stuff. He did not like the leveraging of the Japan stuff. He did not like that Vader leveraged any of his like UWFI work or any of that to get better contracts when he was being paid so much but from Japan to begin with, which is smart. I mean, that's, you know, this is the whole like worker management, you know, financial battle thing of keeping costs low versus worker getting what they can in that limited period of time. I just think it's like really interesting, not only the way it was reported and that helped to kill Vader's like mystique with these people, even though it had nothing to do with this pretend, you know, this scripted thing that they were presenting on TV where he was like, he was a scary dude when I was a kid. Not only that, the other thing that comes out of this for me is we all know that Vader, you know, ended up leaving, but it's weird to think he's so identifiable to WCW for me, even though he had like a reasonable run in WWF. There was nothing there's nothing really grasped during that run where you go like, this is amazing. So it's crazy for me to think that he was never really on. I don't think he ever appeared on a Nitro, right?
No, never.
Yeah. That's kind of nutty. This is almost, you know, we all like to play what ifs with shows like this. How different are things? Like, because Hogan had already kind of like gone through him in a way that I felt was like really inappropriate, not only business wise but also depiction wise for like making money. a very short thing is, I guess what I'll say. Do you think he could have rehabbed himself in WCW or would have been allowed to in that climate on like Monday Nitros?
Well, he turned
the title, yeah,
and he turned babyface.
Yeah, he turned babyface, and if he wins the title as a babyface,
is he like
yeah.
the Hogan
face run? Like, is that what we're looking? Because I feel that it would be, and that's a really fascinating unexplored what if.
Yeah, because Hogan Hogan had some things going on, which we'll talk about in a minute, that was going to keep him out of the ring for a while. So having Vader as a babyface champion, and you're bringing in. Paul White, you know, to be yep. the giant, you know, you could have done an injury angle or something there to set up Hogan coming back working White. Vader against, you know, Paul White at that time period probably could have been a good money match.
And they had already teased it.
And they already teased it.
And Paul White was like, go back and, you know, for people listening to this, go back and watch like some of the early giant matches, Paul White matches. From that, you know, the first year of Nitro, like he was really gigantic and yet agile, and like it might not be as impressive if you're younger and a reference point is Brock Lesnar, say, as far as a bigger guy or like you're into the smaller guys wrestling and the athleticism, but for a big guy, he's pretty amazing. And Vader, I really feel like Vader would have still had something there. That's an interesting, it really is an interesting what if. But yeah, it is kind of, and the other thing is, yeah, Orndorff's a pretty badass old man. Like, I would not want to mess with him. He's almost like a Don Fry to me in my mind.
Yeah, and Big, so Ric Flair has, you know, talked about this numerous times later in his podcast about Orndorff You know, we had a deal where Orndorff bit off part of Tony Atlas's ear, you know, on the road, on Mid-South and stuff like that. I mean, Orndorff was a badass motherfucker.
Wait, Tony, and, wait, Paul Orndorff got into a fight with a black guy? You don't say. I thought Paul, he loved them.
But Paul Orndorff, I mean, that reputation goes back to Tampa when he was going to school there, and he trained with all those tough guys in Florida. So he had that pedigree, but... You know, going back to Vader, I mean, Vader was making some big time money, and I'm sure that the powers that be, Bischoff, whoever, they were probably easier to let him go than maybe somebody else, you know, to get that money off the books. And Vader going to WWF, you know, which he eventually did the next year, you know, we talk about Luger being a bust. Vader was a big bust in WWF. But, yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts about this whole situation?
Me or John?
You.
Oh. WWF thing was... I mean, the thing that was frustrating there is they brought him in so well, too.
Yeah, the Gorilla Monsoon angle.
And the videos and everything. And just it fizzled really fast. You know, I mean, I think we covered, anyway, we covered, I think, a little bit of the babyface run stuff, I think, the last time we did 95, when Brian was on, but...
Yeah, he had just turned.
Right.
That was the wrong venue. Would you say that was the wrong venue? I'm sorry, Bix. I think pretty immediately they hooked him up with Cornette, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But also, even if they didn't, I'm trying to think of, like, the way he was presented. I mean, even from a production aspect.
The man they call Vader.
In Japan and WCW, it felt more raw. It felt more – I mean, it might sound ridiculous in modern times to say this, but back then it felt realer there. It felt more
– organic.
You had to say which one – which one was – I know this is going to sound ridiculous in modern times, but which one was more UFC-ish in these are regular people?
More dangerous.
Right. Oh, good. Great. Yeah. It was definitely, you know, Japan and WCW far more than WWE. I don't know that he would, even if they wanted to push him heavy, they wouldn't just bad videos and like, I just don't see it at that point in WWF's production and what they wanted to do and what they were. And they weren't a big arena as far as live television. I mean, other than pay-per-views, they weren't a big arena. Attraction.
No, it was that place where he did the angle with Gramontune. It was that place in Stockton, right? That place that where they ran like local lucha shows and stuff, right?
Yeah.
I was praising those videos, but then I realized they didn't put him over as a threat. They were just showing him doing backflips on a trampoline and stuff.
And then so it wasn't until later when they put him with Undertaker. You know, I mean, if they had put him with Undertaker early on, then that may have been different. But yeah, I mean,
sorry, Chris.
I'm trying to remember who was his first feud.
Well, they did the suspension thing, and then trying to think, who was it before Michaels? What was he at WrestleMania? I'm trying to think.
Was he not on WrestleMania? Was he Ahmed Johnson? Was he with Ahmed Johnson?
That would have been 12, right? It would have been.
13 was the tag match. Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on this.
All right, I'm vamping right now, but okay. His first appearance is at the Royal Rumble at Fresno,
right?
You know, and then he did the deal in Stockton at the Civic Auditorium, which that was used forever as far as wrestling venues. I mean, UWF ran there, and of course Lucha and all the other stuff. Let's see, Yokozuna. They did the deal with Yokozuna.
Okay, that was his first feud then.
Yeah. Yeah, because Yokozuna had turned face. And I'm trying to find his first in match. Okay, he did work at WrestleMania. Vader, Owen, and Davey Boy against Ahmed Johnson, which I knew Ahmed Johnson involved.
Oh,
Jay Roberts and Yokozuna.
There we go.
And Vader pinned Roberts.
Yeah, that was underwhelming.
Yeah, so there's your deal. And he worked – oh, here we go. The next night on Raw, he jobbed Undertaker with a chokeslam. Wow. I mean, think about that. Think about that now.
You know what they should have done? They should have let him keep his New Japan deal and just bring him in as like a monster attraction in between tours.
But that wasn't on Raw. I will say that wasn't on Raw. It was a dark match.
Still.
Oh.
So, but on the Raw.
It's a lot better, though.
Yeah, on the Raw taping, he broke Yokozuna's leg with a Vader bomb. But still, you know, in front of live crowds, they're having him job to The Undertaker. And they did it again the next night in San Diego.
Chris, and you also brought up the Japanese thing, and this pretty much effectively ends him really making waves in Japan as well.
Until the end of the decade.
Right, right.
When he goes back to All Japan, when he goes to All Japan for the first time and wins Triple Crown and all that other stuff. So, yeah, he does go back, but he's not Vader. Not the Vader of the early mid-90s, but...
That's my point. And unfortunately, they didn't promote in that style. They just didn't. It was the wrong venue in so many ways because they wouldn't promote him in the way that they have in modern times with different people, like mixing and matching, so to speak, as far as showing, making a deal with New Japan to show some of the footage, even if it's just him coming out. You know, they didn't have, by this point, he wasn't doing the thing with the, it's not a mask, but that giant smoke thing.
The headdress.
Yeah, the headdress thing. They could have shown things from magazines in Japan, or even PWI here. But if they just wanted to license a few images from like,
that wasn't their MO. That wasn't their MO in that era.
Yeah,
and again, it's kind of surprised they kept the gimmick.
Yeah, they didn't do that. Well, do you think that this is a classic case of Vince almost like humbling a guy that's not his?
Well, I think it's Vince, you know, getting a guy who was known from WCW and, you know, bringing him in. So it wasn't like Dustin Rhodes, you know, bringing him in as Gold Dust instead of Dustin Rhodes. But mm-hmm. I mean, who really knows, you know, the mindset of Vince McMahon there, because he changed his mind all the time, even back then. But he was never the same after all this situation. That's for sure. Both as a reputation wise inside the ring and outside the ring. So that's just the way it ended up being for old Leon, right? But at the first Nitro, since this is in Minneapolis, this kind of seemed natural. Jerry Lynn was backstage and was talking to the powers that be about getting a job there and coming in the feud with the likes of Benoit, Guerrero, Malenko. And, of course, eventually came on as Mr. JL. But the toss between WCW and Too Cold Scorpio were described as officially dead. Now, Johnny P., we know that at this time period, Too Cold Scorpio was just getting started on his great heel run in ECW. And, man, this was the beginning of about a year-long deal where Scorpio was one of the five best workers in the world, in my opinion. And it would have been interesting to see how his career would have changed if he had went to WCW instead of having that great run in ECW.
It's man, that's one of those things where I feel like public perception might have been different. That's a weird one. You know, like, I don't even know where the end point is to start there, because like we know about that run in ECW and it's celebrated, but when people bring up ECW that aren't people who have like watched a lot of the TV and the ECW arena commercial tapes, they probably don't feel that way. Like, I don't feel like Scorpio resonates for regular people the way he would resonate for us. Like, I don't want to give up. Like, if we're doing like this fantasy, the premise that you gave me, I don't want to give up that year of Scorpio and ECW. But I'm probably pretty biased on like four fronts. The first two being I was an ECW weekly fan. And number two is I'm on a podcast like this. So I'm that kind of fan. He's probably more prominent and probably might even be able to go further in his career. Although I don't think he was going to navigate the politics of WCW in a way that would have made him anything but like a higher mid-carder. He probably would have ended up having like – we probably have a lot of cool matches with him and cruiserweights he was willing to work with that he knew from either Japan
or – it would have been Benoit, Guerrero, Malenko, that whole crew, Jerry Lynn.
That's exactly who I'm referring to. It is really unfortunate, too, when I read this, my heart kind of sank about the Jerry Lynn note, because they attach him in the note in the newsletters to people that I would love to have seen him have runs with at that time. But unfortunately, we got, you know, Mr. JL, although he did have a weird, goofy match with Sabu in the first, like, month and a half of Nitro. They kind of entertained me. I think it was, I'm almost positive that was one of Sabu's Nitro matches that felt awkward in that venue, but still fun.
And I think he could have made that work, Bix. I mean, if they would have let him have that chance, because Jerry was such a great worker. I mean, I can understand why.
He never fit under the mask, though.
Yeah, that was the deal. I think if they maybe went with Unmasked and still called him Mr. JL, maybe that would have been better. But
well, why can't he just be Jerry Lynn? I mean, it was so stupid, too. Everyone knew he was Jerry Lynn.
Well, everyone that be like us knew.
I didn't know who Jerry Lynn was at that point.
Yeah, I mean,
but it was even. You know what, though? I would say it was one of those things that if you were a fan that read Aftermags and watched different promotions, that even if you didn't read newsletters, if you saw a cruiserweight show up in WCW under a mask with the name Mr. JL, you might guess that it's Jerry Lynn.
Yeah, probably. But, you know, really, if you look at it, though, at that time period, the only television that he had been on where he had got any type of push
was Global,
and that was 4 years earlier.
Where had he been? Was he just working Minnesota Indies?
He was just working independent stuff, which is a shame. Because, I mean, God knows, if he would have went, you know, other independents that had television, like Memphis or Smoky Mountain, I mean, who knows what kind of great matches we would have had. But, yeah, it's just another one of those deals where, you know, what could have been?
I feel like he would have stuck around and made some really good money there, too, because he's just universally known as, like, a guy, almost like the Blue Meanie, where, like, people just like having him around, and
he's a good
fine
guy.
Being in that. Yes, oh, he's one of my favorite people that I've met and dealt with of pro wrestlers, and I mean he's on that short list of people like I would feel comfortable having in my house, which is like probably like five workers that I've met and interacted with for more than 5 seconds. But he would have made good money. He would have had some great matches. He would have stuck around. If Lanny Poffo was making. And I know that's attached to the Macho Man thing, but like there are a lot of people that were just kind of hanging out, making money, who weren't even being booked.
It's all about who you were been, tight with. You know that. Hogan, if you're tight with Hogan, Savage, Sting, if you're tight with the right people, then you were all right.
Well, actually, you know, when you think about it, why wasn't Waltman able to get him a big little bit more something?
Well, yeah. But Waltman had his own issues.
Well,
he was a little out of control at the time. I don't know.
Yeah, Waltman was only there because of Hall and Nash.
Yeah, yeah, he had leverage because of them, but I don't think he singularly had leverage. Unless,
no.
What's that?
I would say no.
Yeah, I think he only had the leverage he didn't have leverage. He only had the card to play that he was friends with them. But I don't think that Hall and Nash would have stumped for their little buddy's pal from the Indies.
Yeah, exactly. All right, and we talked about this earlier with Hogan. Hulk Hogan may be doing a movie called Secret Agent Club, which starts filming on October the 9th, which is a movie about kids who are continually rescuing their father, who is a secret agent out of jams.
So it's Inspector Gadget.
Yeah, and this movie eventually came out. 1996, and it's why Hogan shaved his beard. So
that's right.
That's the reason why that happened, and which of course will play into angles later on. But yeah, that's the reason why it's for this movie. So and that was why they were talking about getting the title off of him, maybe to go do this. And of course, once all that thing went down, he never lost and just didn't defend the title. Like I don't know that the title went undefended for.
How many? Well, they did take the title off of him, though.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
It was only about a month and a half later. Yeah.
Yeah, it was Halloween Havoc. That's right. But he wasn't defending the title much in that time period before. So.
No.
But yeah, they did take the title off of him in Halloween Havoc. That's right. Sting, who we talked about earlier, on behalf of WCW, gave a check of $300,000 to the Muscular Dystrophy Association on their annual Labor Day telethon on September 3rd and announced that proceeds from the Fall Brawl pay-per-view would be going to the MDA as well.
Now, do you remember the backstory from this?
No, I actually do not, but go ahead and enlighten us.
Okay, so it was something like $2.50 from each purchase of Fall Brawl would go to the MDA.
Yeah.
Guess how much the price for Fall Brawl increased that year?
Like $5?
Well, actually, yeah, but I think it was $2.50. So it was probably, I think the cable companies matched it or something, right?
Yeah.
You were factoring in the cable company split, but it went up exactly that amount. And I remember on The Clash, there was also this segment with Savage talking to this MDA, like,
yes,
beneficiary kid. And it was so uncomfortable because he clearly had no idea who any of these people were.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was good intentions. But, they weren't WWE in 2015.
They weren't. WWE was always better at any time they did this, they were slicker at it. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. WCW really didn't do that much of it, though. I mean, they did this.
No, they didn't.
They did the thing for... Which pay-per-view was it where they gave to the Starcade 90?
Or 91?
91, I think. Because it was in WCW Magazine, I think.
Yeah.
Starlight Foundation, which...
Yeah.
Always surprised me when that turned out to be real, because it was on Jim and the holograms, and I don't think it was... I don't think it was supposed to be the same charity.
Yeah. I think it's just an ironic incident there with that. And the last bit of WCW news, which would become...
I can hear you cringing at the Jim and the Hologram, the Jim and the Holograms reference.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Well
I had Xavier the biggest smile on my face ever if it makes you feel better, because I remember that too.
I remember
when I watched
that show. I remember that show and I watched it, but...
Well, Xavier Woods...
That's something that wouldn't have come to my mind.
He made a Jim and the Hologram reference on Raw a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, but that wouldn't have come to my mind, of a Starlight Foundation.
Well, the show had just been off the air when that happened, though. The show had only been off the air for a couple of years.
More than that, because that show was off the air when I was like 8, and I was like 87.
Right, and Starcade 90 or 91, so it wasn't that
4
long.
Years.
Okay, it wasn't that long, and it was still on in reruns.
Yeah, I was going to say, Chris, it was on in reruns, I'm pretty sure.
If it was, I don't remember. At least it wasn't here. I put it that way. Atlanta stations weren't there. All right. But in the last WCW story of the night and the week, and this would be a big story down the line, it was all over the news this past week that Time Warner was negotiating to purchase the entire Turner Empire. It sent rumors flying as to what, if the sale goes through, would mean to WCW. Probably nothing at first. And the stories are claiming that the TBS division, which oversees WCW, would remain autonomous. Although people familiar with these kind of corporate takeovers say that any money-losing company is going to be called on the carpet. By increasing the pay-per-views and cutting back on house show dates, the WCW bottom line is said to be much better than its $5 to $6 million annually in losses. Plus, they get a sizable amount of money from TBS to produce the shows, so their books look a lot better now. But it is a company that's probably lost $30 million plus $9.6 million purchasing price for TBS since the buyout in 1988. Bix, this all eventually happened. So,
and in the long run, it led to the end of WCW.
And it led to WCW 6 years later.
Yeah, and then in the short term, there was also all the stuff with Vince and the ad he took out in the New York Times.
Yeah.
Where, what was it? Then they edited it or whatever. It was something like, and I had a caricature of Turner, and it was like, attention, Time Warner stockholders. Will Ted Turner try to spend your money in his personal vendetta against the World Wrestling Federation? It was something like that, right?
Yeah, totally.
And,
how self-involved. But anyway.
Well, that's not like Vince to go have whole personal grudges. But yeah, I mean, this is a big deal, and I think it may have been the biggest mistake Ted Turner ever made in his career.
I think he said that, hasn't he?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he has.
Actually, wait, has he said that selling to Time Warner was it the big mistake, or he said that approving the or that the AOL merger was the biggest mistake?
I think, well, both.
This is the one that led to him not having power over his own, the entities he created.
Exactly. Right. This is the end of him owning the Braves and the Hawks and all other stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, now you're taking his sports teams away from it. It's become corporate owned. And for those of us that are Atlanta Braves fans, yeah, we had success after the fact, but it was never the same without Ted Turner being the sole man in charge, because the Braves became corporately owned and have been that way for 20 years now. So, I mean, now they're owned by Liberty Media, which is a totally different deal, but I mean, it changed the game because the Braves were Ted Turner's team. I mean, they were the flagship of TBS. And like I said, and Time Warner changed so much. Now, TBS, even though it was a national deal, you know, it was a superstation, blah, 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 it still had that Southern feel to it. And then once Time Warner takes over, that's gone. And it was a shame. And like I said, it led to the end of WCW 6 years later. And God knows we know all the corporate BS that happened after the fact, and all the head muckety mucks like Jamie Kellner and all that crap getting involved. So, yeah. But on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to go to the land of the rising sun, Japan. And New Japan and UWFI have quite the press conference. We'll be right back after this message.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Lounge hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Good Will Wrestling with Good Old Will.
from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
And we're back, and we're talking now about what's going on in Japan here on Between the Sheets, episode number 7, September 1st through 7th, 1995. And this is a pretty important week, even though there's not any shows going on, but they're building up the big Tokyo Dome show on October the 9th, New Japan versus UWFI. And on September the 6th, there was a press conference held where UWFI announced the card for the show, where Keiji Muto would take on Nobuyuki Takada for the IWGP / UWFI heavyweight titles, title versus title. And the angle here is that New Japan told UWFI to create the card themselves. They let them have the matchmaking power. So these were the matches made. Shinya Hashimoto versus Tatsuo Nakano, Kensuke Sasaki versus Masahito Kakihara, Riki Choshu against Yoji Anjo, Masahiro Chono against Yuko Miyato, Jushin Thunder Liger against Naoki Sano in a match that was quite great 5 years earlier, Takeyuki Iizuka at that time against Yoshihiro Takayama, Shinjiro Otani versus Kenichi Yamamoto, and your tag match, Yuji Nagata and Tokumitsu Ishizawa, Kendo Kashin, against this young guy named Kazushi Sakuraba and Hiromitsu Kanihara. Now, the way the card is booked is that it looks like New Japan would dominate the undercard, yet lose the main event because it sets up all kinds of big matches down the line with Takada as IWGP champion. But the hardcore fans don't believe that New Japan would allow their prize title to go to a smaller organization, which adds to the buildup. Now, the most notable absence on this show was that Kiyoshi Tamura, who doesn't want to be part of this show because he wants UWFI to become more like Pancrase, not like New Japan. And, of course, eventually it's his departure. Now, the next day, Masahiro Chono went to the press and said that he would destroy Miyato in the parking lot before the show. As they're playing off the angle that happened 3 years earlier when Miyato, who was working as like a spokesman for UWFI, said that he could have beaten Chono for the NWA World Heavyweight title in one of those grandstand challenges that the Japanese love to do. Now we have another deal the next day after that where they talked about the rules. The two groups had a meeting supposedly to decide what rules these matches would take place under on September the 8th, with UWFI represented by Ken Suzuki, Anjo, and referee Wada, with New Japan represented by Tetsuo Baisho, who is the former brother-in-law of Antonio Inoki, and key front office man, and Crook, which that's another long story. Katsuji Nakajima, who would become president years later, and Kotetsu Yamamoto, of course, the famous announcer, and Naofumi Yamamoto's dad. New Japan said the matches should be in the New Japan rules because the vast majority of the crowd would be New Japan fans, and because New Japan fans will understand the UWF 5-point system, which is both men start with 15 points and lose 1 point for a rope break, 3 points for a suplex or knockdown, and if someone runs out of points, he loses, although very rarely the match is in when points run out.
Very rare, and very rarely is almost overstating it. I'm not sure it ever happened in UWFI's entire existence.
Yeah, pinfalls aren't counted, and there are submission matches. New Japan, as the story goes, and also correctly, thinks the crowd will understand pinfall finishes better. Choshu said he's leaving it to members of each group's front office to decide the rules. Anyway, expect an announcement of the rule compromises during this upcoming week. Now, this is an interesting deal here. UWFI is has some issues, and they're working with New Japan. And this show would be a pretty legendary show, Bix. Talk about the Takada Muto, that whole dynamic, and was New Japan right in thinking and not having their title go to Takada at this time?
I don't think so, because Takata's champion drew so well, and it, you know, it seems like they were just kind of doing it to kind of just put to prove they were better in the first match when the real money was with Takata's champion, as went the title switch proved and all that, and, you know, and also that they had him lose by submission to a pro wrestling hold, the figure four. Like, it was very... It was very carefully booked to make Takata look, if not look bad, then not look like a shooter, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it, I think it could have been bigger if they hadn't done that. I mean, it ended up being so successful, I don't think it really mattered. But maybe long term, there would have been more legs to Takata in New Japan if they hadn't done that at the beginning.
I totally agree. And it would set Takata up with all kinds of challengers. I mean, Takata Hashimoto, Takata Sasaki, Takata Chono. I mean, there's all kinds of ways they could have went here. But, I mean, it's an interesting business move on their part not to do that. But, Johnny P., were you watching much New Japan this time period? Or have you seen it since?
No, it's funny is I actually was so bummed that I wanted to watch this whole card, actually. I've only ever seen the main event. Several of these matches are on a list I made. I'm trying to go through the whole 90s with both All Japan and New Japan and kind of just watch everything and make kind of notes about it. I've never seen the whole thing. The thing that strikes me about this is how much I miss the idea of interpromotional stuff on a big scale or even in a small scale. Like I got to go to a lot of those CZW ROH interpromotional feud shows, and that was a much smaller scale, but the atmosphere was insane. And I just remembered the atmosphere of the main event being like really crazy for this, and then when they brought it back, which I think was that was the dome show for the New Year show, right?
Well, Takata stuck around through until he lost the title to Hashimoto in April. He won the title in January and he lost the title to Hashimoto in April, and then he was done.
Yes, and I haven't seen that match. I have seen he was on the dome, though, for the New Year's show in a rematch against
Right,
Mudo.
That's when he beat Mudo.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I've only seen those, and I haven't seen a lot of this, and I want to. So I don't have a massive amount to add other than I do think it was really smart the way they booked it. And I do think I've always felt like some of the notes in the older observers were kind of like New Japan's posturing, so to speak. Like, I feel like some of the stuff bore out in a way that it felt more like for public consumption than insider.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Now, real quick before I jump to the next part, Biggs, talk about the Riki Choshu Yoji Anjo match from the Dome Show.
I'm trying to remember if I've ever seen it, but I mean, he squashed him, right?
Yeah, and they were the bookers. Riki Choshu was the booker in New Japan, and Anjo was the booker at UWFI.
Well, they were the bookers, and also Anjo was the guy, was the disgraced shooter of the group, too, because
exactly
a year earlier, there was the whole thing with the Hicks and Gracie, where they sent him to California to do the Grandstand Challenge, and thinking, this is our shooter, you know, and If you watch old UWFI stuff too, you can sort of tell, like, he seems like he's at least relatively well versed in other martial arts too. Like, he kind of knows some Muay Thai and stuff, like, from what he does in work matches. You can sort of see that he has an idea of what to do.
Yeah.
But Hicks and Gracie just beat the shit out of him.
Oh, God.
And he had the Japanese magazines with him and everything. And so his perception in Japan was never the same after that. And he parlayed it into kind of a decent career as like this, you know, heel in like called Japan and war and places like that. But
yeah, he was a great character.
Yeah. But at this point, you know, it's there's nothing necessarily wrong with Joshu deciding to squash him, though, given what happened with Gracie.
Yeah, totally. And it was an interesting match to watch that way. But yeah, the rest of the card went pretty much according to Hoyle.
Well, also there was Sana. We should talk about Sana Liger, I think, if we're going to talk about it. I mean, even though the card's not for a few more weeks after this, but that was, I guess, that was one of the obvious matches to make. And it was fun because with Sano wasn't working like Shooter Sano. It was just regular Naoki Sano again. And he won, too. He was one of the guys that got...
Yeah.
a big win.
And yeah. Liger was the junior booker at this time.
Right. So, of course, if any of the bookers are going to put someone over, well, I guess Haase wasn't there, so I guess Haase maybe would have been willing to, but if him or Choshu is going to put someone over, it's going to be Liger. And especially, Sano's still his buddy.
Yeah, well, speaking of bookers who put themselves over, Heisei Ishingun, which is one of my all-time favorite groups, they had a lot of bad workers in their group, but it was just a fun, campy group led by Shiro Koshinaka. At this time period, they would run their own shows, which is, you know, a deal that doesn't happen in Japan enough anymore, I think, where these factions run their own shows. But they ran their own show on September 2nd, Osaka, which had these matches as your main matches. Grand Hamada and Wild Pegasus, Chris Benoit, going over Norio Hanaga and Sabu. And Benoit and Sabu would be coming to the U.S. not too long after this. And in your main event, you had Kengo Kimura and Shiro Koshinaka, the two top guys in HI, going over not Riki Choshu and Yoshiaki Atsu, you know, the legendary tag team in the 80s, then followed that up going over Masahiro Chono and Hiroshi Tenzan, who was the top heel tag team in New Japan. So nice work there, Koshinaka. you put yourself over the a legendary tag team and the hot tag team of the era. But yeah, for those Heishi Ishingun, they had some really fun shows. And
Sabu made his New Japan debut on an HI.
Exactly,
show.
As a member of Murder Inc., Chono's group at the time.
And what was that Chono, match that showed? Go ahead.
Chono, Sabu, Hiro Saito, and Tenzan was Murder Inc. at that time period. And I love that statement.
And there was also that match that showed up on YouTube, too, a few weeks ago. With Terry Funk and who was it?
And Masa Saito was involved, I think, wasn't he?
It was when Terry Funk was in Japan for the Fukuoka Jump show.
Yeah.
Which was his New Japan debut.
But yeah, Heisei Ishingun, they have some fun television shows. Go search some of that stuff out for those of you who like New Japan, you know, and see something a little different.
But now, I really do miss the whole concept, though, like you were talking about, of the Muga, Heisei Ishingun, the original Ishingun Dan, all those different, you know, groups within a promotion having their own shows. And they were always fun, and like the different guys they'd bring in. And also, even stuff like All Japan with Kojima having his Bape Star shows.
Yeah, the Bape Star shows, yeah.
Or Early 01 or stuff like that.
Yeah. It's something that doesn't happen nearly enough, like I said. And moving on to other Japan news. Now, if you notice, there's no All Japan this week because there's not really anything going on. They're just doing some house shows and blah, blah, blah. Nothing big. But speaking of big, though, some indie groups are dominating the Budokan as Boz Rutten defeats Minoru Suzuki, we're in Pancrase, to become the new Pancrase Open Weight Champion at the second anniversary show at Nippon Budokan Hall on September the 3rd in front of an announced 15,500 fans. Rutten won with a front face lock choke in 15:35 out of nowhere. And is supposed to defend next against Masakatsu Funaki in January. Now, on this show, Funaki defeated the debuting Guy Metzger. Also on this show, Yusaku Fuke defeated Todd Medina. And the legendary Mari Smith broke Manabu Yamada's arm in a kickboxing match. So, Pancrase, you know, spawned off of PWFG. It was a real big deal at this time period. If you watch the early UFCs, they definitely talk about like Ken Shamrock being the king of Pancrase, Frank Shamrock's Pancrase background, Boz Rutten, you know, Mari Smith. Pancrase would always come up, so it was a pretty big deal at the time. 15,000 fans,
They also did the two or three Pancrase American pay per views.
Exactly, that's right.
Which was UFC's parent company.
Yeah, pimped in the aftermags, but Boz Rutten, you know. Everybody knows him from USC and all that stuff, but he was a pretty big deal in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much his whole career was in Japan when you think about it. I mean, how many fights? He really only had a handful of fights outside of Pancrase. He had the two UFC fights. He had that one comeback fight. I feel like I'm forgetting like maybe one or two, but that was really about it.
I think there are one or two more. The comeback one's the one in LA, right? For some, it was like World Fighting.
It was WFA, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And two interesting notes about that is like how Minoru Suzuki, first of all, he has like the movie star, like pompadour kind of hair in this. He looks like just a guy as compared to like the way we think of him now. And he's so less charismatic than Boss, just in watching this match. And I really do wish we had accurate. I have this sense that like Japan would always announce a number over what it would be. I don't know that.
Oh, you're talking about the crowd?
Yeah, you can't see. It's dark.
Yeah, it wasn't 15.5. That was a claim, but it wasn't really that far off though. So it was kind of close.
The only other thing other than the charisma that comes through a Boss and doesn't really with Suzuki is the giant Lucky Strike logo in the middle of the ring.
Oh yeah,
it cracks me up.
Yeah.
Again, sign of a bygone era.
Actually, yeah, it was only the three fights. It was the wins over Tiyoshi Kusaka, Kevin Randleman, and the comeback / retirement fight against Warpath. So yeah, it was only those fights. So how many total fights are we looking at? So that's 33 fights. Only three of them were outside of Pancras.
Yeah, and you know, and Minoru Suzuki, yeah, he's great now, awesome. But yeah, and this is 20 years ago, you know, and he was a huge name then. Like I said, he was a big time main eventer. So his career's gone well.
What are your guys' read of Rutan's ascendance in Pancras and whether or not guys were jobbing with it to him without him knowing?
As far as I think, there was some screw finishes.
Yeah, because you know the thing is, he says he wasn't in on anything, and everyone kind of believes him. But the prevailing belief seems to be that at least some of his early fights were kind of fixed without his knowledge.
I could see. I mean, that was Japan. I mean, I could see that, but nobody knows for sure.
No, not really.
It's not like, you know, the early days of Pride when, you know, it was so obvious. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we could speculate, but...
Well, if only one guy... That's the thing where Pride screwed up. They were like, maybe they should have done it with only the guy losing knowing because... You know, then you get if you just do a work, then you get something like Takada and Coleman, where they're doing a pro wrestling finish.
Yeah.
Do we know if this particular match was a work or should? I mean, just watching it.
I don't think so. If I remember right, it was like fairly quickly. They, you know, Rutan grabbed that front. Basically, it was a front chancery and grabbed that thing, and that was it. He put in.
Well, it's a legit 15-minute match, but there's no definitive strikes that look like anybody's trying to kill anybody. But the grappling feels, and again, you can do real grappling and just not try to like break a guy's arm. The grappling in the match felt real, but there weren't any like strikes where I went like somebody's trying to like. And he loved the liver kick. I mean, he. Even on commentary, that was kind of like a running joke with Pride. He would always go, he should do a liver kick right now. And he really didn't go for much of that. But if it was a work, it was like the kind of work that you want in these kind of matches. That whole Pancras, like what was real and what wasn't, is like, I don't know, it is sort of romantic. Even like it's fascinating to think about because some of the guys didn't even know, you know?
Exactly. Well, on the complete other end of the spectrum, All Japan Women ran the Budokan on September the 2nd with Manami Toyota going over Akira Hokuto in the main event in front of 14,800. And then the next day at Korakuen Hall in front of a 2,100 sellout, she defeated Yumiko Hata in the finals of the Japan Grand Prix tournament, where she became the number one contender for the WWWA title, which was won days earlier on August 30th by outsider from JWP, Dynamite Kansai, over Aja Kong at the Osaka Prefectural Gym in front of 6,800 people, making her the first outsider to win that title. Toyota won her 10th championship, which broke the women's record of 9 previously held by Bull Nakano. The story about the Hokuto match, though, was up until 60 minutes before the match, she was supposed to win. But she made the call to do the job, figuring it was best for business for the current top star of the company to win over the guest star. What a novel concept, who only works big shows, which was also the mindset of Bull Nakano, who did the same thing for Kyoko Inoue on the same show. The promotion was so happy with the Budokan show that they announced they would run back-to-back shows there next August. Again, Johnny P., amazing, yes, that these women were so unselfish. They knew that they were who they were. They were so confident in who they were that they wanted to do the favors to put over the talent that needed it. This is something that's so foreign in wrestling, and it's so refreshing to see stories like this.
Well, the system over there, like, it feels, and I'm by no means an expert in Japanese women's wrestling, but it felt more like they got them at such a young age and they kind of rose up together that like they would train them from a very young age. So if they didn't have any personality conflicts right away and they got business, especially at the period where it was hot, like it makes sense if you can mold individuals from such a young age to not have that sort of ego. And if you're friendly with somebody, it's so much easier to do than even now. Like, we have less problems with it now because wrestling in North America is kind of monolithic. So it's just kind of like what the office says goes. But the other thing I have to say, the match is really good. It's striking the energy that they have. Like, they, and I just don't mean the crowd. I mean the women draw it out of these people. And there's more light to this event in the arena, and it really does look like the crowd looks real legit as far as the number. And
yeah, totally.
And the final thing I'll say is just the I don't know if I'd call it pageantry, but there's a largeness to that main event and them lifting up Toyota on their shoulders at the end, and like it feels like such a big deal. Like, I, you know, you want WrestleMania main events to kind of feel like that. So yeah,
totally. And Biggs, All Japan Women at this time was probably at their peak as far as in-ring work. I mean, Manami Toyota was amazing in this time period.
I don't know. I'm one of those people that's not as big a fan of, like, athletic Brian Toyota in terms of her just doing too much and stuff. Like, I feel like she got better, like, older, when she got older, like, later on. Like, even, like, her, like, recent-ish stuff, like when I saw her live at that those shows Chikara did. Like, I was never that big a fan of hers. Like, I mean, she had, you know, like the Yamada match, yeah, but not, like, it really depended on who she was working with for me. Like, but, I mean, in general, though, I mean, they had, I mean, we think about just the amazing roster they had, and when you think about someone like, you know, for example, Mariko Yoshida was never really that pushed here. And then finally she gets a shot in Arcian, and look how great she was. So I think that shows just the kind of depth they had.
And, yeah, and, you know, your thoughts about the mindset of Hokuto and Nakano for doing the best for business.
Very unique in pro wrestling. Well, you know what?
That's what I say, yeah.
Well, I wonder if that's just a female versus male thing, too.
Oh, totally. Totally. It has to be. There's a lot of machismo that goes
around. We're all terrible.
With some of these guys.
I was actually thinking of saying something like that, and I was trying to hold off, but yes.
Yeah. You know, Rick, we don't have a lot of Ric Flairs running around who's willing to job anybody, so, you know, it is what it is. But we're still in Japanese women's wrestling in LLPW, where Miki Honda was forced to retire suddenly on September the 1st after a stomach injury at the age of 24, and it was on the day she was supposed to work against Eagle Sawai in the main event of their show, which I didn't say which city. Honda's doctor told her that she needed to retire immediately. So this kind of like sounded like one of those Edge-type deals where, you know, you don't retire now, you know, you could be in serious health issues. So, yeah, I always hate to see somebody retire young, and she was pretty good, too. So, yeah, just one of those things. But now we're going to move on to Mexico. And there's some big things going on now. It's the promotional war is going through some new changes. As we now we got some jumps going, and the MMO we're going to start off with them as Emilio Charles Jr. and Apollo Dantes won the Copa Juniors tag tournament, which featured juniors of famous fathers or guys in gimmicks as juniors of famous fathers. They beat in an upset Io Dos Santos and Rayo de Jalisco Jr. in the finals, which, you know, Dantes at this time was getting that young guy push. And Emilio was, he'd been around a while. So, yeah, I mean, that was definitely a huge upset. But Santo may have precipitated that. As earlier in the week, he gave an interview where he said even though he left AAA, you know, a few weeks earlier, that didn't mean he was exclusive to MLL. And that he would work anywhere for the right price, including AAA. But the way he left AAA, it was known that Antonio Pena wouldn't take him back. And he didn't. So he never came back until after his death. Now, the semifinals of the tournament featured Rayo Santo going over Io del Solitario and Negro Casas by DQ.
Well, talk about a dichotomy in the talent between the two members of that team.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's a big gulf.
Yeah. As Casas got DQ'd for being too rough with his old rival Santo and turned back Rudo again. And in the other semifinal, Dantes and Charles defeated Blue Demon Jr. and Tenebles Jr.
Oh, God.
Who will talk about what he did later that night in just a few minutes. Now, that wasn't even the main event of the show. Here's the main event of the show. Atlantis Corazon de Leon, Chris Jericho, Lionheart, and Vampiro went over the Los Boricuas, El Boricua, Fidel Sierra, Miguel Perez Jr., and Ricky Santana. So what a main event that was. But, Santo going back to the MLL was a huge deal, you know, and it changed the dynamic of AAA. It was the beginning of – I won't say the beginning of the end, but it was definitely the beginning of a
– cooling off.
Different phase of their run.
Well, I mean, it came on the heels of – I mean, you had Art Barr passing away. Then you had – Conan turning babyface, and you had, and then Santo leaves, and it just kind of, and also in the U.S. they stopped working with Scholar too.
Yeah, and then Ray Jr. and Psicosis started getting ECW booking.
Right, so it's just they kind of, yeah. I mean, it's not the beginning of the end of the bloom, but it's kind of, it's the everything's kind of getting into place for everything the following year with the mass exodus.
Yeah, it's the appetizer for what's to come. That's for sure. Now, Johnny P., I don't know how much of the Santo Casas feud you've seen, but it's one of those great all-time wrestling feuds. And it's a shame that we haven't seen them against each other the past few years, because every time they work against each other, it's, you know, pretty damn awesome.
Yes, I'm sorry to say, because you're nice enough to have me on the show, that like we've talked about this off the air different times. Lucha is such a blind spot for me because I have trouble. I have trouble. Full disclosure, Chris has actually sat on the phone with me once to try to get me into a very famous match, which I did not hate, but I could not connect with as a great match. I don't hate Lucha at all. I dislike that I don't connect with it enough, actually. But I drive good old Will nuts the minute I say that I don't connect, as you've been on the line with us, because he right away infers that I think it's crap or I don't like it. I find their history far more interesting in a lot of ways, I guess, because, yeah, I can't connect with the match. It's not that I find it far more interesting, it's that I still love the history, even though I can't fully connect with a lot of the matches, which isn't to say I dislike, I think they're all crap or anything. I just they don't stick with me in the way that like great Japanese or European or a lot of North American matches do.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting until we get back to America. So I won't jump in and try to fake my way through this, guys, just so you know.
Hey, that's all right. So that's cool. We adapt and adjust on this show. Now, Paco Alonso, the boss, was in the newspapers over the week saying that he has talked to Paraguayo, Conan, and Octagon all about jumping back to EMLO, which is complete bullshit. But he was able to get Mascaraña dos Mil and Universo dos Mil to come back, and they made their return on the September 12th Arena Coliseo show. And if you notice, that's just two-thirds of the Dinamitas, as Cien Caras stays with AAA, although not too much longer. But I mean, everybody, even people that weren't smart, I'm sure if they saw that in the news bits that he's talking about Ferro and Conan, which Ferro did come back eventually, but Conan and Octagon come back to MLL, that was, I mean, God.
It's interesting to see him posturing publicly, acting like he would.
Yeah, the fact that Paco Alonso even gave an interview is odd. it's just, again, that was the scene at the time where these promoters are going out there and talking shit on each other.
And but now, finally, 20 years later, it seems like maybe he's starting to finally go back on his
Wagner and Parks back, so. Conan still never been in Mexico, so that's
well. But there was Octagon on All
and
Elite.
Octagon still hasn't come back. Well, he worked All Elite.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I mean, but yeah. Still, All Elite is well that whole thing. I mean,
All Elite's kind of on the rocks right now. That's another whole story. But on to the other group in Mexico, which UWA at this time is pretty much an EMLL satellite organization.
Which still technically exists.
Yeah, but it's basically just pushing all EMLL guys and. Some of the old UWA guys. But AAA, same night, has got a TV taping at Arena Oximilco, which is not too far from Arena Mexico. As you can tell, because Tenebus Jr. made the quick trip from Arena Mexico to make his return to AAA, which he had just jumped from not too long earlier. But it was still a huge shock to everyone, and it meant that he would be on both promotions' television shows on September the 3rd, because they both aired one after the other, and it was from that previous Friday show. So yeah, he's on both shows now. Here's how he made his return though. He came out after a match featuring Chicano Power, KGB, Tom Howard, The Killer, and Nico Zuna, Tonga Kid, and they were DQ'd against Perro Aguayo, Cibernético, Mascara Sagrada, and Octagon when Nico Zuna fouled Perro. So Tenebus Jr. ran out to help, but he got destroyed by the Rudos and even got crotched on the ring post by Nico Zuna. So what a return. I mean, this guy's enjobbed in the semifinals of the Copa Juniors tournament, and then he gets destroyed in the main event angle against a team of quote-unquote foreign Rudos who really sucked. And wow. Yeah, this is AAA. This is not the AAA of a year earlier. That's for sure, boys.
Yeah, nothing says great AAA wrestling that got all those Americans into it like Teeny Ablosh Jr. against Killer.
Exactly. And also making their debuts on this show was Frisbee, who was the former Lasser, and the original Sky Day, and who would become now known as Gato Volador in the Monterey area.
And great, great worker too.
Oh, yeah, he's really good and very underrated because he's a Monterey guy. But, yeah, he if you watch the Monterey tapes that our buddy Alfredo had years ago, he's one of those guys that stood out. He was one of the Power Rangers down the line, Power Ranger Rojo in AAA, you know, earlier that year, actually. So
he was Adventure in California.
Yeah, he was Super Azteca 2, I mean, and El Azteca 2. He had a lot of gimmicks. But
he was the original El Sagrado.
Yeah, the original Sagrado. But he was Frisbee on this show. And then we had Vegas, which Vegas was a cool gimmick. It was like a Mexican version of the Million Dollar Man. Now, that was the former Dragon de Oro. But we all know this guy as Black Warrior. And people were raving about him, which... If you saw Black Warrior in the late 90s, you would know why. That dude, and even into the early 2000s,
oh, yeah.
Phenomenal. But he got old real quick, mainly because of his style. But if you watched Lucha Underground and you saw the Tope of Deaths that King Cuerno did, the guy that was the king of that, El Rey del Tope, was Black Warrior. I mean, he would go deep in the crowd with his topes.
Oh, he has one of my all-time favorite topes was him when it was the Satanico, Black Warrior, and Shocker against Guerrero still Inferno and Tarzan Boy feud. It was on that one Arena Coliseo show. Do you remember the one I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, the ultimate one was on the first Ruleta de la Muerte pay-per-view that OCSA ran in 98. And he hit a tope on Mr. Niebla. And this one, Mr. Niebla was actually good. And they went flying deep into the crowd. It was insane how and it was at such a fast speed. Like it was just boom right there, like a missile.
Did he ever work at any IWRG shows back then?
I know he worked Nakopon.
Because I'd love to see him do a tope in Arena Nakopon.
Yeah, that building is very compact.
For anyone who's never seen it, because they're always, especially like just if you used, especially on all that old IWRG stuff, like the topes that guys would hit there were legendary.
Yeah,
way they just go flying into the rail and then into the crowd and.
Yeah, it was like watching New Jersey All Pro shows in the old grocery store in Bayonne.
Oh, the charity hall.
Charity hall, yeah. But back to Vegas. Vegas was teaming with Jerry Estrada and Heavy Metal. And they were defeated by Frisbee, Latin Lover, and Ninja de Fuego, where Heavy got destroyed by his partners afterwards, only to be saved by his former partner, Lover. Now, I didn't mean that his former partner and Lover. His former partner, Lover, which Heavy Metal's turning Technico again. So that's the angle there. Also this week in AAA, on September the 4th, 16-year-old Paraguayo Jr. had his first ever trios match, where he teamed with Frisbee and Rey Mysterio Jr., defeating Juventud Guerrera, Psicosis, and Vegas, which sounds like a fucking kick-ass
team.
That
sounds so
good. Oh, my God. When Perito used a double foot stomp on Juve to win, Perito was said to have looked green and tentative, but for his experience level, he was very good and extremely over. Yeah, that's one thing, I remember watching, this era, on television, and yeah, you could see that he was going to be a star. I mean, he had it at that young of age. And, remember, he was 16 in 95. So, if you were watching in 2000, he was just 21 then. And he was so good then. I mean, he was – Perito was, awesome. And, Bix, I know you watched a lot of that stuff over the time period. He was one of the saving graces of AAA. In the era where they had a lot of problems.
The Big Four,
The Big Four of him, Hector Garza, Heavy Metal, and Latin Lover. They were, and then you add Zorro into the mix. El Dandy would be in there at times. I mean, it was awesome. But yes, this is still just a shame that Perito left us so soon. Mm.
Hey, Chris, this is one thing I can add to this. When I read this note, my heart sunk knowing, Rey Mysterio was in the ring with him when he passed. I mean, the videos were all over YouTube. And just like the 20 years later thing, it's just like you really get the sense as human beings, like how much that must have. Well, it's really sad for Aguero Jr.'s family, but also just Mysterio, because he was rather young then too.
Yeah, he was in his first trios match, and then he was in his last match altogether.
I mean, Ray was only 20 at this point, I think, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yes. Ray was really young. Yeah, so it's just,
but they're contemporaries.
Not only are they contemporaries, but practically grew up together in a sense. And for that, that's a weird symmetry to that story, and it really is sad.
Yeah, totally. Conan, who we talked about, has been appearing in the children's play The Giant Rapper in Mexico, which I don't imagine that was, but it keeps interfering with his wrestling schedule, so he is planning on quitting the play in October, which coincidentally is also around the same time when he starts taking bookings in ECW. So, interesting how that goes. And Conan ECW, Ray and Psicosis came in first, in September. And then Conan came in after they did. And him and La Parca debuted, I think, on the same show. But Conan eventually got higher profile matches. You know, he had to deal with the Sandman and other stuff. But yeah, Conan 1995, I mean, he had a great look about him. And of course, he wasn't, you know, a world class worker. But you could definitely tell that, I mean, he was a guy that was headed for some things, but I don't know. It was just some.
He was a very good worker when he wanted to be.
Yeah. I think he's one of these guys where I think if he would have stayed in ECW, he would have been a lot better off. What do you say, Johnny, or what do you think?
Well,
he did eventually adapt. Like by that last match at the arena he has with Sandman in January, I remember really enjoying that. But I also remember that
you were the only guy. You were the only guy in that building who was enjoying it. I remember the way the fans were chanting.
In fairness, I wasn't in the building.
You weren't out of the building for that one.
No, so my perceptions of it are completely from TV viewing. But I did see it. I would have been when I was doing the film. I did come across it. You know, and it's probably in clipped form because I don't remember that part. Which leads to what I was going to say, which is that first match was heavily clipped.
The tag match.
Yeah, see, maybe I'm flipping this because, see, I remember that being the one that was like heavily clipped because there were some screw ups and
him and
the,
Ray
the
against La Parca and Psicosis.
Remember? Yeah.
See, I remember him complaining in a Torch Talk about them editing that too.
Yeah, they did.
Well, they did. It's barely on. It's really clipped on the TV
because he's
show
like he felt like that. Paulie was like sabotaging him. And only showing the clips where the other guys look good and not showing him getting his high spots like he did a spider. I remember him saying he did like a spider German suplex and stuff and he did all these cool spots. But they made him just look like a guy who was being carried by all the more spectacular guys.
I think it's fair to say that Paulie had a great affinity, much more of an affinity for Ray Jr. and Psicosis. And Conan probably became a necessary evil to get those guys in. Like, I think that's fair, but I don't know that he was trying to like sabotage him or anything like that. I mean, Ray and Psicosis were essentially the replacements for Malenko and Guerrero because, you know, they had left the show before.
And then Ray became, you know, there by himself. And then, of course, Hoovy would come in later, but yeah, you could tell that Paul had plans for Ray.
Because he mixed Ray. He started to mix Ray into other storylines a little bit, like the 9-1 thing with 9-1-1 and the Eliminators, and he had the match with Mikey. And
yeah. Yeah, he had plans for Ray, but of course Ray had greener pastures ahead of him. So he did what he had to do. And speaking of ECW, we are not a lot going on this week, but a few little news bits. The Eliminators, who had just worked a dark match for WWF, I think in August the 12th or something like that, are rumored to be coming in soon, but will have a different gimmick.
Well, that didn't end up happening. I mean, it did, but they were the Eliminators.
They looked the same as they did before, so it really wasn't that much of a difference, although they would change a little bit later. Conan, which we just talked about, is supposed to debut on October 7th and supposed to feud with Tuco Scorpio, which
Did not happen. I mean, he came.
That would have been interesting.
Would
have gotten out of them.
Yeah, that would have been an interesting matchup, no doubt. Now here's two good news bits. ECW is supposed to return to Prime Network this upcoming week, but Prime is denying it to the people that are calling asking about it. Bix, how long was it before they got back on Prime?
I don't remember because, I mean, there was that whole confusing thing we talked about a few weeks ago where we're trying to figure out, like, what was them on Prime? What was them actually buying time from MSG? When were they only on MSG via the Prime Network feed? Because, like, Prime was how they got carried to individual regional sports channels that they didn't actually buy time from individually.
Yeah.
But I don't remember when they got back on, and exactly now. I mean, because this was stemming from the from the caning angle, right?
Yeah, it's from Sam and Mikey.
Yeah, I don't remember when they got back on there sooner or later. I mean, they were, yeah, definitely.
And Johnny P, ECW and television outlets was it's like the Randy Orton versus announcer table feud of the 90s, where Randy Orton could never break that announcer table. Paul Heyman and television providers was always a problem. They just never could get along.
Oh, where do I begin? first of all, Bix did the greatest job ever of trying to unpack this for people who wouldn't understand the television landscape with these sports channels and these like regional networks and national feeds a few weeks back. I could have done, unfortunately or fortunately for my sanity, I didn't have a section of, because we would throw just things on to organize on different timelines of by subject that we wanted to really explore and see what we could make out of all the footage from, you know, 50 odd interviews. We didn't do that. We had no interest in doing that for TV because it became very apparent right away how confusing it was. But I would estimate that I could have done a very, very boring, like maybe even like an hour and 40 minute documentary just on the footage we had of people trying to explain television stuff to us on these, like, and Tony Lewis is one of the best because he was the fan who kept bugging MSG and trying to get them back on. And like, I've heard Tony tell that story, not only on tape because I had to edit it, but also like just in person with Tony, who's a wonderful guy. I still don't fully understand all the nuances of the MSG thing and all these things. They were constantly like in researching when we decided to finally finish it, I had a month to get like my mind back into this project. So I just started reading all ECW news from any newsletter I could get my hand on for like a month. And it is not everyone. I mean, you guys are probably going to encounter it for the remainder of this show for its run. Every week is Paul Heyman giving nonsense information or real information mixed in about what television stations he is and isn't getting on. And the final thing I'll say about this is, you know, in the film we have a bunch of the fan convention footage from all different years. Every one of them, when he holds court and takes questions from ECW fans, like there'll be people, because wrestling fans are goofy to begin with, and ECW fans were a special breed. Every one of them would like raise their hand and be like, I live in like name random city, and a lot of times not major markets. Can you guys get on TV there? And Heyman would tell you the name of the station. He would tell you the program director and give a dissertation on the market and what he had in that. And who knows fully what's true and what's not true. You know, I don't even know. But I don't know how he had time to even deal, or him or Todd Gordon had time to deal with all these different stations they claim to be negotiating with to either buy time or get on or getting kicked off. The whole thing was insane. I can't imagine in modern times trying to deal with all these different TV stations on a one-on-one basis when there's like a million markets.
I can tell you about Atlanta. Atlanta, they got on Channel 69 Atlanta, which that was the last place that Pedicino was on. Well, he was on a very small station after that, but they got on there, and they weren't on long because they got on in early 96, and then came the Beulah Kimona angle, and they got taken off after that, and then they came back. I want to say right around the time of the Shane Douglas Pitbull 2 feud. So they took them off TV for like a month and a half there, or That's 2 months. Fair. Then they came back, and they ran that for a while, and then once Raven started the stuff with Sandman and his son and all that stuff, they took him off again. And that was it. They didn't come back.
That's literally the story of every market. Like, I can't imagine. Like, they must have had a giant corkboard in an office where they just, like, put, you know, the station name on a pad and, like, flipped it from one side to the other, on, off, try, okay, who do we have to call this week and deal with? These people. Who do we, because another big thing as the timeline goes on, by, like, 97, like, every one of the newsletter notes becomes, they owe, you know, 10 grand to this random station, and they're talking to this station, and they claim that station owes them money, even though they had to be paying for everything. It's really ridiculous and kind of funny to think about. Now all we have to worry about is, like, you know, is WWE going to re-up with USA? How much money? And then, like, is anybody else going to find any station worth a salt to be on? That's pretty much the entire discussion.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember, just to finish out this whole side discussion, like I remember reading, I think it was a John Lister's Slamthology book, which was a collection of all the different stuff he'd written over the years for, like, newsletters, and I think maybe in for Power Slam. Actually, maybe not for Power Slam, mostly just for various newsletters and stuff. And, like, they included various, like, travelogues and stuff of going to different stuff, like the ECW, you know, internet conventions. And I don't remember who he was talking to, if it was, like, someone from The Office, or it might have been Sandman, who was just fascinated when he found out that in Europe that there was really no such thing as a time buy, and that really anything, any network worth its salt, was paying for programming, and how fascinated they were by this concept.
That's crazy. And yeah, it was a different place over there. But ECW, talk about opening up a building near Forest Hills, New York, in a vacant warehouse where they want to create their own version of the ECW arena in New York, starting in October. And they also have a date on September 23rd, Middletown, New York, which that's where they mainly ran their shows at. But this never happened.
I don't think the second Middletown show ever happened either.
Yeah, I don't think it ever happened either. But
No, it did, and I think that
it wasn't TV.
That might have been the one that was moved to Sports Fest.
It was the Inside show. That's where Austin came out.
Bingo, that's where I was going.
Oh, right, it was in Middletown. That's right, it wasn't at the fairgrounds.
Yeah, it was inside at the sports bar, and that's where Austin came out, I think, for the first time in the ring.
Yes, that was his first appearance in front of a crowd. Yeah,
that's right, yeah. That's
but
right.
The building in Queens, they didn't really... And they started running Lost Battalion Hall in December, I think?
Yeah. Yeah,
but there was nothing in... Where in Queens was that?
So Sabu had his first television match in the Battalion Hall.
But where in Queens was that? What was the place they're talking about, though? I mean, they didn't get a warehouse or anything.
I have no idea.
It's not specific, and it might have been complete nonsense. But it would have been very interesting to see.
Yeah.
And you just want me to say something that'll get me heat with Heyman in case he somehow ever hears anything from this show.
And the thing about eventually they did find their own version of the ECW arena in New York. It just took him 3 years with the Elks Lodge.
Yeah, the Elks, and then Heyman started fanning the fires of the feud between New York and Philly fans.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I was more of a Philly guy, and also I was in love with the Sportatorium / ECW Arena, like underground fight club type feel that Lucha Underground is like the closest thing now as far as the depiction. But I know that this is sacrilege. I'll probably get like angry calls from certain friends. I never got into the whole Elks Lodge thing. I like reading this here, like, or hearing Chris say it rather, like, I so wish that would have happened. I wish that wasn't just Heyman nonsense. And probably what happened is that they were going to try and just buy the building on the cheap or something. And then the building was like, no, this actually is going to go for a couple hundred grand. And they didn't have the money.
Well, they know. Yeah. It's not like they own the ECW arena.
No, that's fair. But then why, like, I mean.
Then what are they even talking about?
Yeah, they would have had to, like, if it's a vacant warehouse, then they look, what probably happened is that Heyman just was spouting off at the mouth one night and said this to somebody. But, I mean, if we're taking this seriously, by this point, Todd Gordon's gone as far as, like, money ownership. And this is a New York thing anyway, which is totally straight up Heyman, because Gordon was very Philly centric and made that clear when I interviewed him.
Yeah.
This, if it's really a vacant warehouse and that's not just like shorthand writing and kind of lost in translation details, because it says lots of talk. Well, Heyman would have been the one that started that. He's the New York guy and the owner. if it's a vacant warehouse, the reason I made the ownership comment is because I feel like they would have tried to buy the building, because if it's vacant, then like it's not even set up to really have fans
right.
in it. There's, where are you getting chairs? Where are you getting bleachers? Where are you trying to recreate the CCW arena? You would have to like, you know, even rent or lease the building.
Yeah, and neither of the buildings they ran were Forest Hills. The Lost Battalion Hall was Rego Park, and the Elks Lodge was Elmhurst.
My bet is that this is where they wanted to have, like, the House of Hardcore, the training, and they were going to use it dual
use. That's what I was thinking,
and
that ended up being in Long Island.
Right. Yeah,
a guess and not, all, you know, something I know factually.
No, I'm saying the same thing as I'm starting to read this, and then I'm surprised when it's not about a wrestling school.
Yeah. Well, they definitely were looking at a venue in New York. They wanted to run there, and it made sense to make that jump. I mean, that was a good business move. So, and again, like I said, it worked out for them eventually.
And it was weird because the way they flirted with it for so long. Like, they had debut in Yonkers in '94.
Yeah.
Then they didn't go back to the New York era for a long time. Then they did Middletown, which was still kind of far from the city.
Well, I can kind of throw something into that, which is that it is very apparent to me from doing the documentary that Heyman wanted to pull power to New York, and Gordon would have that was like a weird underlying thing within their very complicated relationship, is that Gordon probably wasn't playing ball with that. And even by this, I mean, he's still involved. So here's the funny thing about this. Like I had mentioned a minute ago that like by this point, Heyman would have had full control, but Gordon was still doing a lot of the business stuff. And Gordon would have probably been, he would have either been a part of getting a building, or in this case, he probably would have completely handed off to the New York guys, which mean it would have been completely on Paul to negotiate something like this.
And so after Gordon left, you know, that's when they started traveling more and more outside of Philly, in the Philly area.
Yeah, they debuted at the Elks Lodge, I want to say, in February of '97.
Yeah, because that's right around the time that Raw ran at the Elks Lodge, and then they invaded there.
Manhattan Center.
That's right, in Manhattan Center.
It's right after, because Gordon, even though they were running New York, they didn't do TV. I don't recall, and Bix, correct me if you know, I don't recall a TV taping until right around when Gordon's gone.
Well, I think the main deal with that was because they weren't on Time Warner.
MSG, wait, what?
They weren't on Time Warner Cable. That was a big deal in that, wasn't it?
Wait, they weren't? No, because MSG was Time Warner.
Pay-per-view.
You're thinking
the pay-per-view. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, pay-per-view.
But that wasn't until, that's not until 97 anyway. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but they weren't taping TV from New York, though, until around that time period, because that's when the big promo happened. You know, it was at that TV taping.
You're thinking of the Cablevision promo.
Cablevision.
That's 98.
Yeah, but still, they weren't taping TV until late 97.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. We're getting way off track. With Bigelow winning the title was at the... that might have actually been the first Elks Lodge taping. Bigelow winning the title.
Yeah, because that was right when they were starting to push Just Incredible. In that time period.
That's right. And was that the same taping where he beats Oscar?
Yes.
Okay. So I think that was the first Elks Lodge taping.
Yeah. So that was October 97. So we're 2 years after this, you know, what we're talking about.
Right. Because even then, the Lost Battalion Hall was really just a handful of shows.
Yeah. But anyway, moving on to another independent organization run by former heel manager, Smoky Mountain Wrestling, Buddy Landell. Which we talked about this on the last 95 show we did, where he was turning babyface. Well, they pulled the trigger on it at a house show in Barberville, Kentucky on September 2nd, which was shown on television, the whole angle, where during a tag match with Tommy Rich against Bob and Brad Armstrong, Landell was put out with an ether-soaked rag that Jim Cornette had brought into the ring to use on Brad, but was not down by Brad, who stole it and used it himself on Bud Rowe. The heels argued afterwards, and Landell punched Cornette before jumping on Rich, getting a figure four on him, which saw Terry Gordy run out, and then he got small package like Jack Briscoe used to do guys whenever he had a guy jump on him as he had a figure four. And Landell then let go of them on his own, slammed Cornette, put him in the figure four when the Punisher ran out, of course, Punisher Bull Buchanan. And Claude Budrow with a blackjack prompted him to get beaten bloody for close to 10 minutes with the ring covered in blood when it was over, as no one made the save. Yeah, this was a pretty wild angle on television. Budrow, he had that, the blonde hair was completely wet with sweat, and then he was covered in red, and it was, you know, taped at a house show, so it wasn't professionally shot. So, I mean, it was a gruesome looking deal. And this was a great angle to get Budrow over as a face fix.
Yeah. I'm thinking as you're saying this, it sounds so weird that today, the babyface is not making the save, doesn't have the same impact, because no one makes saves for anyone anymore, really.
Yeah.
Unless they're, like, in the same program.
Yeah.
And it's so weird. I mean, I guess it's more of a WWE thing, but you really don't see it that much elsewhere. Even it's so weird, isn't it? That no one does saves anyone else anymore.
And the whole psychology behind this was Landale was
right, right. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Had no friends.
Right. So that's the
which these days the nobody has friends.
Yeah. I mean, it's and so right. I mean, you can't if you did a turn and you did the same thing, it wouldn't have the same impact.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but you know, Landell, you know, they built this up so well. I mean, we talked about it last time with the promo leading up to Super Bowl where he talks about his addictions, all stuff. So this was a long time coming at this point, and they really did a tremendous job with this. I mean, this is the last. This whole thing is really the last great big storyline in Smoky Mountain.
Yeah, and. Johnny P, Smoky Mountain Wrestling, you know, they were on their last legs at this time period. They would close the doors, you know, a couple months later. But, they were still going strong as far as angles and stuff. And that's one thing about Cornette. He knew how to book, but sometimes just the way that the business was done just wasn't the best.
Yeah,
sounds like Heyman, doesn't it?
There's so many parallels between those two. In fact, at some point we were thinking about even, you know, adding that as some kind of extra, because we would ask people to compare and contrast their careers and what they did. I did watch this around the time after Buddy Landell passed, and I thought it was really well done. It was too little, too late, but I thought it looked pretty cool. It felt, I don't even know the words. It would sound like ridiculous, or I'd say, but it was like palpable. It had some weight to it.
Yeah, it was in a basketball gym, and I mean, it happened at a house show, so it was just it added a little extra grittiness to the whole angle.
Well, this is not what I'm thinking of then at all. If this happened at a house show, I apologize.
This happened. It was shown on television though. I mean, so it was televised.
Okay, so maybe it was, okay.
Yeah, it was shown on TV.
It was definitely a Landell face turn, so okay.
Yeah, it was shown on television in full, the whole beatdown. Well, not completely in full. They didn't show all 10 minutes. But yeah, it was definitely shown on television. But like I said, it was like when ECW would show fan cam stuff.
Right.
It had that type of vibe to it.
Miss that so much about, I mean, even going back to like, WWF, when Windham and Rotunda won the tag titles from Adonis and Murdoch, like just any time where it was something that was at a house show and you were supposed to get the idea that this was a house show and maybe they happened to shoot everything but it's not professionally shot, you get that it just adds to the idea this wasn't supposed to happen. It feels more spontaneous, it feels more unplanned, and that's something you don't get anymore. I mean, I think to like stuff like even down to little things like WWE with camera angles and stuff. Like, New Japan these days, and this is one of the things I love that they do, you'll have guys ruin, like, the perfect shot or something like that. Like, in WWE, like, or even places where, you know, they won't, like, I hate that everything just is too reliant on looking polished, and it's more effective if everything looks polished, then if nothing looks unpolished, then it can't have an effect, it can't affect you. Like, if something looks, you can show, like, because it's not even, like, they don't even show, like, I mean, not that they even really show clips of house shows anymore, but if it just doesn't look as professional, you're showing the clip, you think, oh, they weren't thinking this was going to be, you know, not anything was going to happen here. This means that wrestling's real because they didn't make a whole show of it.
Yeah.
That's that whole Kevin Dunn influence. It's kind of that move away from, like, live sports, you know, and it started happening a long time ago. They just didn't have it down. It was actually good we got this grace period where they wanted to move away from it, but they weren't good enough yet. And then they just got to a point where, you're right, it's this subconscious thing too, where, like, if everything looks so pretty and flows, then it looks so canned and, like, it looks like you've seen it week after week, that nothing really sticks because there's no cameraman following down. There's no cameraman trying to follow action where he can't get past, like, a crowd of, like, even when they do brawls, it feels like they find a way to get cameras, like, almost like over top or inside of a brawl. And I know they do it because they're like, well, you have to see it, but I want to see something chaotic. Like, I do kind of miss that old, like, brawling around, like, ECW arena where it's just like the, you know, Charlie, the cameraman is, like, chasing people, knocking people out of the way, or the old fan cams where they would yell, like, Doug or Gabe would yell, camera, 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 and they're, like, pushing people, and it would hit the handy cam, and there would be that jarring effect.
Yeah. Or even, like, when WWF would do, like, Attitude Era brawls into the crowd, like, I'm thinking, like, Undertaker and Austin at SummerSlam, they would have, like, the crane cam, but... And they don't really do this now. Like, if nowadays, if they have guys going to the crowd, they follow them with the handheld. If they just if they did it with just the crane cam, even though it's the in theory it's almost the more majestic, expensive looking thing, it looks more chaotic because you're seeing them amongst the fans. Whereas now, if it's they have a handheld and they're right in front of you, so it almost loses the impact of them being in the crowd.
Well, and they hold off the I imagine as Kevin Dunn, who's, because he's the executive producer calling the show, they'll cut off of the handheld camera in the crowd, the mobile cameraman. They'll cut off of it till he has the quote getting the shot.
Right. So they'll have something else in the ring as the focal point until the guy on the handheld has the shot.
Right. Until he's in position, they see it on the monitor, and then they go to it. Even that just sucks, you know. I mean, I get the idea of it, but to not ever deviate from that is a problem. It creates, with them doing that, and, like, in general, wrestling has lost that because everything has to, you know, and Meltzer will talk about how everything has to look a certain way with production. And I think they fold that into this, whereas I think there is value. It sounds like we all feel this way. There is value.
Oh, yeah.
To deviating from what you do, so after a while, I mean, the segments are so almost time stamped and everything now, other than just going long sometimes, that you just feel like, I saw this last week and the week before, and they don't deviate in a way that is unique and therefore makes a segment stand out and leads to memories where you're gonna 5 years from now go, remember when they did that and it was crazy?
Yeah. Well, back to Smoky Mountain, a couple of quick notes. Dr. Tom Pritchard, as part of the storyline, had his foot injured by the Thugs, Dirty White Boy and Tracy Smothers, during the month of August, and now he's debuted his new special silver boot, which is a ripoff of the Grappler's loaded boot gimmick, which, you know, that Grappler and Tom Pritchard had worked together many times over the years in different places.
Actually, hadn't Pritchard done this somewhere too, like Continental?
He did in Continental as well. So, you know, an old school loaded boot gimmick. And then, speaking of old school, Mongolian Stomper, 61 years old, wins a battle royal on a spot show in Clinton, Tennessee on September the 2nd. So, and the reason why they do stuff, they would bring Stomper in, is he's a legend in the market. So,
and he was living in Knoxville.
Yeah, he lived in Knoxville.
And he was in great shape, too, for his age.
Yeah, totally. Now, moving on to the other Tennessee organization, the USWA. Jerry Lawler on the live Memphis show on September 2nd, quote, exposed, unquote, Jesse James Armstrong as the roadie from WWF, which set up a singles match between them, which saw Brian Lee run out for the DQ, where he came out and power drove Lawler. Lawler then said that he was going to make a phone call to the WWF and get the toughest guy he could to be his tag partner on September 4th in the Mid-South Coliseum, which was Labor Day night. Against those two, and ended up being Sid Vicious, which after the phone call was made, and sounded jumbled, which was said, that's a shock. The heels joked that he got the dumbest guy in the WWF. And then Lawler instead eventually lost by DQ on the show. Now, it was funny because Sid was doing shots in Memphis a lot during this time period. So it wasn't like it was this big, you know, mystery surprise deal. But I always dug Sid in Memphis, Bix. I mean, he was really good. He was always pretty much a baby face. And he was like a different type of guy. It was like he was at home. Well, he was at home. So I always dug Sid in Memphis.
Yeah, all that 90s Sid in Memphis stuff. Like, I mean, there was the heel run, too. But he was this, I think you can, I don't, maybe even there's no real argument about it. He really was at his best as a performer in Memphis.
Yes.
And then especially that, like, 94-95 run. I mean, he was having, like, he was never great in the ring, but seemed like he had a better idea of how, maybe because he was at home working Tennessee style that he grew up watching, like, he had a better idea of how to, like, have a good main event match and stuff like that, and he was cutting better promos than he did elsewhere. I mean, he was good. I mean, if you watch some of that stuff on TV, on YouTube, it's pretty surprising compared to what we're used to from Sid elsewhere, and, like, even, like, what was that gimmick he had, like, in Power Pro? What was the name of that group he had with the bikers?
Oh, God, I haven't watched that stuff.
You remember what I'm talking about, though, right?
Yeah.
P.O.B. or something?
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
Yeah, but, I mean, even then, it's like, it was fun. It was even, like, wasn't really good, but it's still kind of fun, just watching Sid doing this other stuff. But you can tell he's having a lot of fun, whatever, he's in Memphis.
Yeah, and one of the other characters in this, Jesse James Armstrong.
How do you expose that?
It made a big deal about how the roadie was such a, you know, this weasel character and all this other stuff. And, yeah, it was like he was insulted that came out. But Johnny P., Brian James, Jesse James Armstrong, Road Dogg, you name it. This is when he really started to get into his own. He was really fun in this whole Memphis Smoky Mountain feud and everything going on. Underrated guy. I mean, he's more known for the New Age Outlaw stuff that came later, and they became a tired act. But I thought he was at his best in his career in this era.
I think that's fair. I want to jump real quick. I think Sid actually benefited from the lack of production values and the depiction of – it wasn't really that he was depicted differently, but like Memphis – felt like you have things in that studio and you have this giant guy and like Memphis was the one place where kind of like the everyman tough guy could, I mean, like, look at Lawler, you know, those guys could prosper and there was like a reality basis to it. And I don't you know, it's kind of like this weird concoction. There's no one like definitive line that I could give about that, but I always thought in the things that I saw with him in Memphis and doing anything in studio, and I know in this case he wasn't in studio, but I always thought that he benefited from it not being a big production, like with because McMahon would have always wanted him to look larger than life, whereas here, just as around the everyman, he was larger than life.
Oh yeah, I'll say.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Memphis, the performers there are more smaller and, you know, lesser weight. And he does, you know, it comes off as a dominant figure.
Yeah. And as far as Jesse James Armstrong goes, I think you're right. I think I personally don't give him enough credit because I like some of his brothers more. But he's another guy.
You mean all?
All of his brothers more. you know what? I guess that would be true. That's
really great as a promo at this time period.
Yeah.
No, he's always been comfortable. I've always felt like he was pretty comfortable on the mic, even, you know, with earlier stuff.
Yeah, he's the one that took after his daddy the most on the mic. That's
Yeah.
Well, not just in the mic, in the ring too.
Yeah, there's a lot of Bob in him. No doubt.
I always get the Armstrongs jumbled. Was it? It wasn't Scott, or was it? Or no, it was Brad that had the matches in Mid-South with DiBiase.
Yes,
Brad.
In the mid-80s. I always really liked that. He was always the worker in the family that I enjoyed the most.
Yeah.
Whereas I thought Jesse James Armstrong was the best on the mic of the brothers.
He was the most charismatic, best on the mic. And he was, as far as like experience in the business, he was on and off for a while because of military service, but he was still only in his second year as a professional.
Really, and full time, he was less than 2 years in. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he kickstarted that second half of the Smoky Mountain feud, which, you know, the first half was mainly Rock and Roll Express and all that stuff. Second half was him and Tracy Smothers dominating. And that's a really strong television, especially after Smoky Mountain shut down and Bob Armstrong started to come in. Oh, just great stuff. But moving on to a category called Potpourri Various. The Dallas Sportatorium reopened on September the 1st with a well-promoted show put together by Tim Roberts, a.k.a. Sweet Daddy Falcone, Guido Falcone, Mike Smith, not the former Falcons head coach, but Sam Houston, and, of course, Father Grizzly Smith. And they had help with local rock station KEGL. The building had new paint, a cleaner look, better sound system, and new lights. They gave all the fans free programs. The programs are far more professional than the type that used to be sold there. The atmosphere was much improved. They bought ads during the WWF syndicated shows and cable shows in the market. And they drew a strong crowd of 900 fans in the building. The bad news is the quality of wrestling was at or below the Jim Crockett level, which Crockett ran there the year previous, with nothing better, no match better than a star and a quarter. And the same wrestlers as before, as Angel of Death, Action Jackson, Johnny Mantell, Chris Adams, Tim Brooks, Sam Houston, Scott Puskey, and the Sicilian Studs. Biggs, I don't think this group lasted very long, but it is always interesting to watch these groups try to run the Sportatorium in the 90s and just fall on their face.
Yeah, and also Dallas had lost some key talent leading up in 95 because they had Michael Hayes had been around in Dallas and in like the surrounding areas, like into Louisiana and Oklahoma on other indie shows, like working with Chris Adams and guys like that. And he had gone to WWF, and Tony Norris did too, because he was one of the
Mo Adib.
He goes, as Mo Adib, as himself. And then he went to WWF as Ahmed Johnson. And I'm trying to think. So you had Global goes out of business. Then you have Crockett's NWA. Then you have this briefly. Then you have the CWF, right? Or CWF or CWA? It was CWF, right?
Yeah.
Which I think was at first Confederate Wrestling Federation. Then they realized that was a bad idea and it became Championship. Was it Championship Wrestling Federation?
Something like that.
And they were the ones with the Bodyguards versus Bandits pay-per-view. And I think no one really had a sustained run. And then Gary Hart tried doing his World Class 2, The Next Generation. That was pretty much it, right? I mean, he had occasional lucha shows and stuff, but that was about it.
Didn't Hart also didn't he have some shows in there just around the same time as Global or right before?
Yes, that was the Texas Wrestling Federation at the Metroplex Arena, which was a warehouse type place. Yeah. And they had TV.
Did Kevin run there as well, like using other people's money?
He brought back World Class when he kicked Jerry Jarrett out, and that didn't last long.
Yeah, because they came back. They ran for like a month or two in 90, and in 91, Jerry Jarrett was back and before Global took over. So, yeah.
But as far as the overall climate, do you think anyone could have done anything, or was just a matter of that World Class and the Deaths had just killed the market?
If you were going to be successful there, you needed fresh talent because that talent was tired. And you needed to stay the course. It wasn't going to be a success overnight. So you just needed to build on it. That was the only thing I could think of.
Also WWF and WCW didn't draw great in Dallas for a long
time. No, Dallas had taken a lot of blows.
It was Austin that revived Dallas as a wrestling market.
Exactly. And because he's a local boy. So of course.
It strikes me as kind of funny, like obviously you have the deaths are the kind of the variable in this science experiment I'm about to go with here, Because the reason that I got in ECW was because it felt like the sportatorium when I would watch Legends of World Class and like Dying and even Global on ESPN. And so often people would compare the two.
The music and yeah.
And the feel and that I always refer to it as that Fight Club kind of look with the audience kind of going crazy or people in the ring. It's interesting the way they both aged. Like this, just nobody could recapture anything or strike something new. And then they just kind of leveled the building and they needed a venue. So people, you know, they would argue, just give up the legacy. And I always argued, and there were some of us in the Philly area that would always argue like, look, well, this isn't about ECW and its legacy and recapturing something. Although a lot of promotions went in there and tried that, like XPW and debatably you could say Todd Gordon and Blue Meanie's 3PW. But the only other venue that was viable in Philly to do indie wrestling was in Northeast Philly at the Armory, where ROH ended up running for a few years. And I'm just glad that they didn't have kind of the deaths or anything, and they overcame over time the ECW arena aura thing. Because now that is, again, a really nice, viable and that place got taken away. I mean, we had to fight to get our premiere in there that came down to the wire because the woman who owned it was just letting it sit there, and it was like a shell. And thankfully, you know, Roger came in with some backers. I'm going to butcher his last name, but he had been kind of managing it at the end of ECW. And they refurbished it, and thankfully they have a building, and I just wish – And, you know, and I'd never been to the Sportatorium. Maybe it really was a dump that wasn't worth saving. But I really kind of wish, as somebody who loves wrestling history, that somebody could have done for that building what happened for the ECW arena.
Yeah. I mean, well, here's a question. Which is actually in a relative worst part of town?
I don't think the arena's in that bad of a place. I know that
Sportatorium
always
was. Yeah. That's the thing.
That's my quote, so I'm asking the question.
Yeah, Sportatorium was on the bad part of Dallas. So there's your answer.
Well, and that's also part of why it was a problem. Like, you really, like, maybe if you had a nicer, someplace in a better part of town, maybe you'd be able to get people to come just to see a show.
Yeah.
But you can do that. Like, before we move on, like, were any of the other places, like Longhorn Ballroom or anything, were those in nicer parts of town, or?
Well, no, they weren't big. That's why nobody wanted to run there.
That's why Tim Brooks would run the Longhorn Ballroom, because he wasn't drawing anything.
Yeah, he knew he couldn't get in the Sportatorium, so you had to run wherever you had to. But yeah, it was what it was. But moving on for the last group tonight, the World Wrestling Federation. Not a whole lot going on here either, as they're reeling from the debut episode of Nitro and Luke leaving.
Well, and every year for years, it was, you had SummerSlam, you had the U.S. Open preemptions of Raw.
Yeah.
Maybe, they would have taped, usually they taped TV pretty far in advance, and then you'd have...
But there was no Raw that night because of the U.S. Open.
Well, that's what I'm saying, and then they'd have these breaks, and one year, like, they even taped in advance, they taped the post-U.S. Open shows, like, over a month in advance, but generally they always had a post-SummerSlam break.
Yeah, so there's not a lot going on. We have Tatanka is suspended. No official word on why, other than it wasn't drug-related. But people think it was due to an out-of-the-ring altercation with a female in Anaheim in December 1994. The key word in that whole sentence is Anaheim, because that's WrestleMania's location the next year. And there were some people feeling that it wouldn't be good PR if he was still in the roster by the time WrestleMania came around.
Yeah, and that whole thing. And did he ever come back from the suspension, or was he just gone
Never.
Until he came back a decade later?
Yeah, that's when he came back, yeah. So, yeah. And I don't know if we ever really found out what happened, but there was a physical deal with that.
Well, didn't they also let go Jimmy Del Rey over the same thing?
Yeah, pretty much. But that was earlier. They were gone
Jimmy Del Rey go, yeah. But I think that was why he was let go, wasn't it? Wasn't it the same altercation?
Yeah, that was something. Diesel, world champion, suffered a severely bruised lower abdomen thanks to Mabel at SummerSlam and won't be back in action until September 15th in Montreal. Although he did cut promos at a TV taping on August 28th and August 29th.
Is that the Montreal show I'm thinking of? Where he has another interesting situation with the match with Carl Ouellette?
Yeah, that's the one. So, this is an interesting time in the Kevin Nash Diesel title reign, which is just falling apart at the seams. And, WWF was having their problems. And the last thing, and this is great. While watching the debut episode of Nitro on September the 4th, there were talks being held by the brass of Titan Towers on holding an emergency TV taping. But it turned out to be that WWF filmed their new opening for Monday Night Raw on September the 7th on top of Titan Towers with everyone brawling. And that opening debuted on the September 11th episode of Raw. The filming cost $100,000 for just about 3 minutes of airtime, or three minutes of footage.
And if I remember correctly, that new opening lasted about 3 or 4 weeks before they went back to a new version of the old one.
Yeah. So the thing about this, Biggs, reading the newsletters, is like people were fully believing that for the 1 week that they were holding an emergency TV taping to counter Nitro on the 11th, because they had already taped that show on August 28th, which the main event of that show was Shawn Michaels and Sid. And there was talks that they were going to hold this TV taping to kickstart their Mania angle, which who knows at that time if it was Shawn and Bret or not.
Yeah, so, didn't you put in the notes? But in the Torch, didn't Keller say something like that? There was that the rumored main event of the emergency TV taping was something like Shawn versus Bret.
Yeah, Wade Keller was the one that was running with this. Dave didn't really mention anything about it that much, but yeah, Wade was the one that had his sources tell him that that's what the plan was. Then next week it was it was to tape that opening.
Although Wade and Dave were both talking to Vince at this point.
Yes.
I mean, that's not exactly a secret. And
yeah.
I mean, Wade ended up even getting, within a couple months, getting an on-the-record interview with Vince.
Yeah.
Which I don't think anyone else ever got, right?
No. But, Johnny P., I mean, we're seeing here where, you know, if they're going that far just to tape an opening, they are shaking in their boots.
Yeah, and if they do the emergency taping, then you never get, I mean, it's a footnote to history anyway, but the whole big guy loses after two super kicks or three super kicks line from Bischoff. Yeah, like, that just seems like an obscene amount of money for the company for that time to be taping a new opening. But
yeah,
I doubt that Meltzer or Keller were faxed like an itemized list that added all up to 100.
Well, they did. They rented a helicopter, though, didn't they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, they would have had to, because those shots. But wow, what the hell cost $100,000? I mean, maybe that the helicopter rental was like at least a third of it.
The cameras and all that production. I'm sure once you add all up with crew, having to pay the wrestlers.
Well, and also this was the thing on the roof, and I think they had to reinforce the roof too.
Yeah, so
they would have had to fly everybody into New York and then drive them up. Then I guess, right?
Yeah.
So
they had to pay. They probably paid some of the fans as extras.
Yeah, because they did have that. So yeah, it was just
maybe they all adds up. Yeah.
Yeah, they're shaking. They've been shook.
So, I wonder. I do wonder what kind of who on the staff talked them out of the idea of the emergency TV taping, or if Vince pitched it and said no. Like, which way was it? Is what I would be curious to know about. Was it his idea and they talked him out of it, or were everybody going, we should do something, and he said we're fine?
I'm pretty sure Vince was the one that was made the final decision and talked him out of it.
Yeah.
But,
where would they have done it? Was the idea that they would have done it at the opening taping?
They may have. I mean, there was never any word about where it was rumored to be held at.
But I mean, that makes sense because they had. I mean, they did bring in local fans to be the fans for the intro. Like, maybe maybe that was the idea, that they had a ring, that they had a set, they had fans, they were shooting. Maybe let's try to shoot matches here.
That would have been
could
horrible.
Have been.
That would have looked really bad, I think.
Well, WCW just ran a mall, so
fair enough. What was their take? Where were they that week? Because it would have been interesting.
They
to
were
see
off.
What...
They were.
Oh, so they didn't even have house shows.
They had done. They had done house shows in Canada. They okay. did. They did a run up there, and I'm trying to think where else they were. They had a split cruise, so part of the crew was in Canada. And part of the crew, I'm trying to think about where they were at. I mean, look,
they didn't do Raw in bigger, massive venues at that.
And then
time.
The first live Raw wasn't until the 25th, the night after the pay per view, right?
That night they were scheduled to be in Oshawa, Ontario, with a crew there, and Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario.
You mean on the 11th?
No, on September 7th.
Oh, okay.
On the 11th, they were in Orlando.
So they had a show if they really wanted to run live or something, too.
Which, that show was main evented by Razor Ramon and Sir Mo in 1 minute.
Oh, God.
Drew 600 fans.
Oh, my God. Was this at the Amway Arena?
At the arena, yeah.
600?
Yeah. Here's your card. Hakushi defeated Rad Radford. Savio Vega defeated Duke Drossi. Bertha Faye defeated Alundra Blaze. Davey Boy Smith defeated Bam Bam Bigelow. Goldust defeated Bob Holly. The Blue Brothers defeated the Bushwhackers. And Razor Ramon defeated Sir Mo.
They would have been better off doing a taping, you know, and this is all spitballing because we don't know. They would have been better off doing a taping in Canada than trying to hustle over maybe 48 hours or less of giving away free tickets in Orlando to get people in that arena.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
yeah.
At that point, you might as well do a taping on the roof of a building you own.
In Canada had better talent because on the Canada house shows, they were running Aldo Montoya against Triple H, Henry Godwin, Dean Douglas, Fatu, Waylon Mercy, Barry Horowitz, Skip, 1-2-3 Kid, Jean-Pierre Lafitte, Owen and Yoko against the Smoking Guns, Brett versus Isaac Yankum, Undertaker versus Kama, and Shawn versus Sid. So.
You know out of curiosity, do you know the attendance of that show?
There's no attendance. That's in Sudbury.
You know, I think about, you never really hear about it anymore. Vince's reaction to the, he beats the big guy with the three super kicks, and they didn't do it long, was to add next week on Raw type segments where they showed clips of the matches from the next week's show.
Yeah.
And, like, his idea was, and you could tell it was something he told Wade directly, was, okay, we're action adventure, we're scripted programming, we can be like Melrose Place, here's what happened, here's a taste of what happens next week on Raw. We're taped, that's fine. Which I thought was an interesting way to respond.
Yeah. It showed some gumption, I guess, on Vince's part, which, you know, he had plenty of that.
To his credit, he really didn't panic.
No, he didn't. He stayed the course, and we saw what happened in the end. And on that note, we come to the end of this show. And it's time for the plugs. Johnny P., what you got going on?
I don't really have anything wrestling-related. Like, if you're one of the people who would be interested in you know, a documentary about ECW that isn't completely wrestling-centric. You know, this isn't about, you know, storylines and angles and on-screen depictions as much as, like, the culture and the human interest story of these guys killing themselves for next to no money and trying to band together to be part of a dream that and what happens when a dream crashes. Then go to barbedwirecity.com and get a direct download video.
And also, the only ECW documentary that's not produced by WWE or TNA.
Exactly.
Correct.
And it's so good. Johnny does such a great job on this. And
thank you so much for that. And something that I recall just before we went on the air here is that Chris is actually a consultant. He was listed as a consultant in the credits. And some guy named Dylan Hayes, because, and this is not a self-deprecating comment. This is not about me, But the person, the jerk off who was given typed notes to then put on, put into the film, the titling, he didn't bother to check what he had typed. So, and that was not me. I'm not making a veiled reference to myself or Kevin Kiernan.
Would this be someone who was involved in promoting professional wrestling in the Philadelphia area?
It would be, unfortunately. It was somebody that we had to partner with to get this done. And I just hope I never see that person again. I'll just say that.
Well, shit happens, I guess. And that yeah. Dylan guy, he can get over it. We know how he is. Bix, you always have a lot of crap going on. What's the latest on you this week?
Oh, I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. Well, okay, the new Fighting Spirit came out. I don't have anything in it because the WBF article got delayed till next month, as I think I mentioned before. But get it anyway, because Fighting Spirit is awesome. Fighting Spirit Magazine, it's fightingspiritmagazine.co.uk. Or get them on their iTunes store, or Google Play, or whatever. Just got my stuff going on the Observer side, on Wrestling Inc. Really nothing that big going on as far in my world this week, I guess. I mean, I'll have new Figure 4 out with some Snuka stuff. I guess kind of my own take on it with some, found some different things that, from what's been covered so far. So, yeah, I mean, that's about it in terms of me for right now, I guess.
Good deal.
And I guess plug also the if you buy anything from LuchaShop.com, use the coupon code BIX for 10% off. And, also got my Amazon thing on DavidBix.com if you want to click through there to use my Amazon referral and stuff.
Good deal. I will be a guest. Well, I'll go ahead and say it. I don't give a fuck. I'll be a guest on the WasmCast podcast this week, which I'm looking forward to. After I made the statement on Twitter that I was too controversial to be on that show. So,
now, wait. Is it a regular Wasim cast or is it a Freysim cast?
It's a Wasim cast.
Oh, okay.
I don't think Frey's on there, but if he is...
The next time they do a Freysim cast, I really want to be on.
Well, I met the brother Frey at the ROH show. Saturday before last, and we had a great time. But I'm looking forward to that appearance because it's no holds barred, as we say. So you'll hear some hot takes coming. But other than that, of course, we got this show we do every week, and of course we haven't booked a guest for the next week yet, or said a week, but of course it will be good no matter what.
You say this every week. It's not like we've ever done it in advance. So
I know. We were just flying by the seat of our pants. And, of course, Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame season is now in effect. And expect to hear a lot of Exile on Bad Street coming up in this next 30 days or whatever until the Hall of Fame ballots are all in. I plan on doing as many shows as I can. So, a lot of audios coming down the pipe for you Exile on Bad Street fans. But other than that, we're going to sign off tonight. Johnny P, it was an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. Definitely going to have you back in the future. Definitely when there was a heavy ECW week. That would be a great time to have you back on.
Definitely. And thank you guys for carrying me through my weak or blind spots. And I'm actually glad the Japanese stuff, some of the random, the pancreas and the women's match, I actually knew pretty well. So
yeah. Well, hey, we try, like I said, we adapt and adjust to the guests, but, thank you for being on the show. Bix, always a privilege to have you as the guest host.
Guest host? And am I the guest host or am I the co-host,
guest host, feature player?
Yes, I'm like the featured player on SNL. You're a cast member. I'm a featured player.
Yeah, exactly. You are the like the Chris Kattan of the late '90s, maybe, or maybe even Adam Sandler of the early '90s.
No, I'm like when they had the two casts. And they had like the two sets of featured players. They like remember when they had like 24 people, like and random people like Beth Cahill.
Yeah.
I'm like in the Beth Cahill tier.
No, you are the co-host. So, like I said, always great to do these shows. And for Bix, for Johnny P, this is Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.